You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankfort with the March 27th edition of Takes on the World, a program in international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to get your takes on the world. While Rachel Maddow and congressional Democrats are still in a state of shock over the failure of their hero, Robert Mueller, to deliver Donald Trump's head on a platter, the president's White House has not let up in its efforts to bring down the governments of Iran and Venezuela. Overthrowing governments that Washington doesn't like is, after all, a national pastime that goes back to the earliest days of baseball. Today, about 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to be speaking with Professor Lee Arts of Purdue University Northwest's Global Media Studies Department about the latest moves by the U.S. to remove Venezuela's elected president, Nicolas Maduro, from office and replace him with an American-trained telegenic stooge, Juan Guaido, who, without being elected, is recognized as the country's president by the U.S. and 50 other countries. One of those countries, it should be noted, is one of its immediate neighbors, Brazil. On Monday, Brazil's recently elected president, Jair Bolsonaro, called on his Ministry of Defense to carry out, quote, due commemorations, end quote, of the 55th anniversary of the military coup that took place on March 31, 1964. On that day, with the backing of the U.S., Brazil's President João Goulart was overthrown by the heads of the army, which imposed a military dictatorship in Brazil that lasted until 1985. However, the Ministry of Defense's spokesman, General Otávio Regio Barros, stressed that the Brazilian president does not consider the 1964 episode as a military coup, but instead thinks that, quote, the society, perceiving the danger that the country was living in at the time, joined civilians and the military, end quote, to recover and reunite Brazil. If all that had not happened, said General Barros, we would be having some kind of government here today that would not be good for anyone, end quote. It remains to be seen who the new Brazilian government will be good for, but it has been welcomed by President Trump and his executive branch henchmen Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. Last Tuesday, Trump hosted Bolsonaro in the White House, and New York Times writer Michael Shear and Maggie Haberman described the two as meeting their mirror images. Like other authoritarian leaders, Mr. Trump has embraced since taking office, they wrote, Mr. Bolsonaro is an echo of the American president, a brash nationalist whose populist appeal comes partly from his use of Twitter and his history of making crude statements about women, gay people, and indigenous groups. They say he's the Donald Trump of South America, Mr. Trump marveled during a speech to the Farm Bureau in January, noting that Mr. Bolsonaro had been called the Trump of the tropics since taking office this year. Do you believe that, said Trump? And he's happy with that, said the president. If he wasn't, I wouldn't like the country so much, but I like him. Meanwhile, back in Venezuela, Caracas and outlying provinces suffered another power outage on Monday. Was it an example of government incompetence or further evidence of U.S. efforts to destabilize the country and empower and enlarge the rank of its opponents? A memo from September 2010 by a U.S.-funded soft power organization that helped train Venezuelan coup leader Juan Guaido and his allies consider the potential collapse of the country's electric sector as, quote, a watershed event that, quote, would likely have the impact of galvanizing public unrest in a way that no opposition group could ever hope to generate, end quote. It was produced by the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, called Canvas, notes investigative journalist Max Blumenthal. It's a Belgrade-based democracy promotion, end quote, organization funded by the U.S. government that has trained thousands of U.S.-aligned youth activists in countries where the West seeks regime change. The group reportedly hosted Guaido and the key leaders of his Popular Will Party for a series of training sessions, fashioning them into a Generation 2007, determined to foment resistance to then-President Hugo Chavez and sabotage his plans to implement, quote, 21st-century socialism in Venezuela. Fast forward to noon of March 7th, when during a hearing on Venezuela at the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee, Senator Marco Rubio explicitly called for the U.S. to stir, quote, widespread unrest, unquote, declaring that it, quote, needs to happen, quote, in order to achieve regime change. Venezuela is going to enter a period of suffering no nation in our hemisphere has confronted in modern history, Rubio proclaimed. And around 5 p.m., the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant experienced a total and still unexplained collapse. Residents of Caracas and throughout Venezuela were immediately plunged into darkness. At 5:18 p.m. that day, noted Max Blumenthal, a clearly excited Rubio took to Twitter to announce the blackout and claim that, quote, backup generators have failed. It was unclear how Rubio had obtained such specific information so soon after the outage had occurred. According to Jorge Rodriguez, the communications minister of Venezuela, local authorities did not know if backup generators had failed at the time of Rubio's tweet. Back in Caracas, Guaido immediately set out to exploit the situation, just as his canvas trainers had advised over 8 years before. Taking to Twitter just over an hour after Rubio, Guaido declared, quote, the light will return when the usurpation of Maduro ends, end quote. Like Pompeo, Blumenthal observed the self-declared president framed the blackouts as part of a regime change strategy, not an accident or error. You'll be hearing more about Venezuela 20 minutes past the hour when I speak with Professor Lee Arts. Trump, meanwhile, startled the world on Monday when, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at his side and a handful of American Jews whom he has appointed to run his Israel-Palestine policy standing behind him, he announced the U.S. would now formally recognize Israel's sovereignty over the occupied Golan Heights captured from Syria during the 67 war. Another Israeli Prime Minister, Menachem Begin, who gained notoriety as the head of the terrorist gang Irgun and his image on wanted-for-murder posters in Britain before Israel's establishment, had declared the Golan Heights to be part of Israel in 1981, stealing the headlines from Ronald Reagan's first trip to Israel for Europe from the front pages. For the past 52 years, Washington, like the rest of the world, had considered the Golan Heights to be illegally occupied, but, like the rest of the world, it had done nothing more to end that occupation than it has done beyond talk to end the occupation of the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza, also captured in the 67 war. If you are among those who still believe that the Oslo Agreement was intended to end the latter occupation, history as well as the wording of the document would indicate otherwise. Trump's recognition of Israel's possession of the Golan is being seen both in Israel and the U.S. latest significant gift to the embattled Israeli prime minister who, charged with multiple instances of corruption, is facing a difficult re-election challenge on April 9th from retired General Benny Gantz from the new Blue and White Party, who was in Washington this weekend to speak at AIPAC's annual policy conference, as was Netanyahu before he flew back to Israel. Following the wishes of Netanyahu and Jewish mega-billionaire Sheldon Adelson, Trump has successfully pulled the U.S. out of the nuclear deal with Iran and reinstituted the crippling economic sanctions on Tehran, recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moved the U.S. embassy there, canceled financial aid to the Palestinian Authority and withdrew U.S. funding from UNRWA, the U.N. Relief and Works Agency, which has been providing economic assistance to Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, and the occupied Palestinian territories since 1948, when the new state of Israel ethnically cleansed more than 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and villages. What Israel has done for the U.S. in return is a question no American official or media pundit dare ask. The answer would be nothing. That this has been the agenda of Trump and his inner circle and not the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence agencies is rarely recognized by the media, but there it was on the front page of the New York Times on March 20th, where, writing from Kuwait, reporters Edward Wong and Edward Schmidt acknowledged that Washington's attempt to isolate Iran, including by punishing Iraqi militias and politicians who are supported by Iranian officials, has deepened tensions not only between Washington and Baghdad, but also within the Trump administration. According to their article, U.S. military and intelligence officials worry that the increasing pressure on Iraq risks infuriating its parliament, including politicians linked to Iran, which could limit the movement of the 5,200 U.S. troops based in Iraq. In other words, the U.S. military and our intel agencies do not see Iran in the same light as do Israel, its most loyal supporters in the U.S., and the Trump White House. This is critical since the latter's actions are pushing the U.S. toward another war in the Middle East, not in pursuit of America's global interest, whatever one might think of them, but those of Israel, which I and others have argued was the case with the war on Iraq. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, whose confrontational stand on Iran, the Times writers note, has already strained ties with European allies, is leading the push for Iraq to confront his fellow Shiite majority neighbor. He arrived in the Middle East on Tuesday to speak with officials in Kuwait, Israel, and Lebanon about containing Iran. Under plans recommended by Pompeo and White House officials, the State Department would designate Iran's Military Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization. It would be the first time the U.S. has designated a unit of another government's military as a terrorist group. American officials who disagree said it could put U.S. troops and intelligence officers at risk of similar actions by foreign governments. Other Iraqi Shiite militias would also be listed as foreign terrorist organizations, which would subject Iraqi officials who support them to new economic sanctions and travel restrictions. The plan was leaked to the New York Times by anonymous sources, but Pompeo confirmed that he was looking at various groups, including the Revolutionary Guards, after he was asked by the Times on the flight to Kuwait about the proposed designations. "There may well be other organizations that we designate," Pompeo said. The State Department, the Times noted, designated the Iraqi group as a terrorist organization this month, despite opposition from the Pentagon. Iraq's militias, some of which are trained by Iranians, operate with Baghdad's approval or financial support, and several are legitimate players in Iraqi politics. They are part of the popular mobilization forces composed of about 50 paramilitary groups that fought against the Islamic State and are paid by the Shia-dominated Iraqi government. The Times quoted Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi of Iraq as saying, quote, "The Americans can make the decisions they want, but what the Americans see is different than what we see. Our position on the popular mobilization forces is very clear and well-known," end quote. Iraqi leaders were already irate over the Trump administration's insistence that they comply with American sanctions imposed against Iran after Trump withdrew from a nuclear deal with Tehran. Tensions between Washington and Baghdad have only risen through the winter, noted the Times. In February, you may recall, Iraqi politicians bristled after Trump said American troops in Iraq would monitor and pressure Iran. Iraqi leaders have been resisting demands by Pompeo to stop buying energy from Iran, another issue in which Pentagon officials have sided with Baghdad. Iraq officials also remain unhappy by the closing of the United States consulate in Basra, the country's second-largest city, where a temporary halt of electricity exports from Iran led to violent rioting last summer. As with Iraq, the pressure campaign has angered leaders in Lebanon, where Iran-backed Hezbollah is a major military force, holds parliamentary seats in alliance with the largest Christian party, and runs a health ministry. Pompeo has told Iraq's leaders that they must stop buying Iranian natural gas and electricity despite the lack of other affordable options. Last Tuesday, following urging by senior Pentagon officials, he agreed to extend a waiver of the sanctions allowing Iraq to buy electricity from Iran for an additional 90 days in the middle of Iraq's scorching summer. Last month, Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi said that Iraq would not comply with the sanctions, citing the 13 years of U.S.-backed U.N. sanctions against the government of Saddam Hussein that cost the lives of over 500,000 Iraqis. You might remember Madeleine Albright being asked about that, and she said it was worth it. Now, as then, most Americans don't seem to care, and it is not on the agenda of any of the Democratic Party presidential hopefuls thus far, nor is it likely to be. Where Iran was mentioned over and over was at AIPAC's annual policy conference that concluded yesterday. Yeah, you haven't heard about it. The conference only rated a brief, albeit rare, mention by Don Gagne in yesterday's All Things Considered, but it was the relations of Jews to Israel that was the focus, and the short clips of Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Vice President Mike Pence spoke to that. What I would advise all of you to do, if your stomach can handle it, is go to AIPAC, AIPAC.org, and watch the speeches of Mike Pence, Hoyer, Pelosi, New York Senator Chuck Schumer, an interview with South Carolina's Lindsey Graham, to understand how right on the money Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar was when she criticized those politicians who have an allegiance to a foreign country, and how serious a problem that is for not just Americans, including Jews, but for all the people on the planet. For an entirely different perspective, and one that largely represents my views, I urge you to watch speeches from another conference that took place last Friday at the National Press Club in Washington that received no press coverage. Sponsored by the Washington Report and the Institute for Middle Eastern Policy, or IRMEP, whose director Grant Smith has been a frequent guest on this program, it was titled, quote, "The Israel Lobby and American Policy." And you can find all the presentations, including Smith's, on YouTube as well as on C-SPAN. One last note. On my last program, I played a speech of Kamala Harris to AIPAC in 2017. This year, like the rest of Democrat presidential hopefuls, and cognizant of the lack of support for Israel by the party's base, Harris decided not to attend the AIPAC conference. So AIPAC came to her. Several AIPAC officials from California came to her office, where she posed with them for photos, then tweeted her support for Israel. And AIPAC promptly took credit for her coming to the conference, saying, tweeting, "We are delighted that as part of AIPAC policy conference, our leadership met Senator Kamala Harris, who reiterated her support for the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship." Here's Harris's tweet. "Great to meet today in my office with California AIPAC leaders to discuss the need for a strong U.S.-Israeli alliance, the right of Israel to defend itself, and my commitment to combat anti-Semitism in our country and around the world." That was Kamala Harris yesterday. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطيه قوساق زحف طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This is your host, John Roberts. For a feature presentation this morning, we have a real treat for you, and that is the keynote address that Susan Abalawa gave at a recent conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Susan is a renowned Palestinian writer and activist and founder of the organization Playgrounds for Palestine. As a speaker and promoter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, she seems to be appearing everywhere, including here on This Week in Palestine. So here is Susan's introduction and the keynote address she gave in Washington, D.C.
When we announced that she would give this keynote address, Philip Farha, I know you're here, said his wife's reading group agreed Abulawa's book is the best they'd ever read. And he said, "I really put her up there with Charles Dickens." Her debut novel, Mornings in Jenin, was translated into 28 languages. Her second novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water, has likewise been translated into 26 languages. Abulawa's first poetry collection, My Voice Sought the Wind, was published by Just World Books. All those books are for sale at the Middle East Books and More booth and on our website. Her third novel will be published soon in 2019. She's the daughter of refugees from the 1967 Six-Day War, when her family's land was seized and Israel captured what remained of Palestine, including Jerusalem. She was born in Kuwait, raised between there and Jerusalem, then in the Carolinas, where she completed high school, university, and graduate school, majoring in neuroscience. She enjoyed a successful career in biomedical science before becoming a full-time writer. I first heard her poetry years ago at an ADC convention And as a child who also grew up here and there, always searching for my own homeland, I listened to her poetry and wept. She currently lives in Pennsylvania with her daughter, their cats, and dogs. In 2001, Susan founded Playgrounds for Palestine, a children's organization dedicated to upholding the right to play for Palestinian children. To help raise funds to build more playgrounds, she has launched IDA, a private label olive oil from Palestine. You'll find her bottles and books in the Ideas Fair. Abu Hawa is often invited to international poetry or literary festivals. Audiences in every country in the world can listen to her voice, except in her own homeland. In November 2018, Israeli authorities barred her entry into Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport and prevented her from participating in a panel discussions at a literature festival in Ramallah in Jerusalem. She was detained for 32 hours, many of them spent in an Israeli jail cell, as she appealed her decision. An Israeli court upheld her deportation. Please welcome a powerful voice for Palestine.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that generous introduction. It's really great to be back at the Washington Report. This is an institution that was one of the main sources, the first sources we had for independent media, and it's an honor to be the keynote. I want in this talk to try and examine the nature of Israel in the world. I'm going to try and present a survey of Israel from multiple angles that are going to seem disparate and unrelated. They include democracy, nature, global weapons, friendship, and archaeology. Most of us in this room understand the colonial and apartheid underpinnings of Israel, which manifest in the unrelenting daily horrors and indignities for Palestinians. On the other hand, some folks see Israel as a benevolent place trying to exist with Palestinians. But I would like to look beyond this kind of contained binary framework relative only to Palestinians, because Israel is so much more. Every country in the world, of course, has good and bad elements. But I do think it's possible to pinpoint a kind of general imprint for societies, the way they exist in the world, and also, more importantly, how they impact the rest of the world. And to do this, I found that national spending data are useful. When we look at Israeli spending, we find that it is second only to Saudi Arabia, that other bastion of human rights, in spending, arms spending per capita in the world, exceeding the United States military spending per capita, as well as exceeding U.S. military spending as a percent of GDP. I'm going to talk about what all of this means in real life. But first, I want to touch on the prevailing perception of Israel, which has been cultivated through sustained, multi-tiered, multi-pronged public relations campaigns that present Israel as an unfairly maligned modern democracy, one that is advanced, socially enlightened, and endlessly innovative, from such absurd claims as having invented falafel to the equally absurd claim of being less than 1 year away from curing cancer. It's actually a real thing. What is promulgated through popular international media is typically not merely an exaggeration of reality or even just spin, but it's often precisely the opposite of reality. A case in point is this article in Scientific American, a respected magazine that translates scientific information for laypersons. The article touted Israel's desalination plants as unprecedented ingenuity in the region, using language that comports with the old proposition that Israel was a miracle that made the desert bloom. The reality could not be further from that. Two implicit lies in the title and subtitle alone. First, Arab nations in the Gulf have been using desalination technology for the past 50 years. But more important is the little-known fact that Ramallah's annual rainfall actually exceeds London's annual rainfall, and Jerusalem's rainfall is nearly on par with London's, plus it's way sunnier. The point is that Palestine isn't and never was dry, desert, or barren. This is the cover of a detailed audit book of all the ways that Israel has profoundly and detrimentally altered the natural biomes, landscape, hydraulic potential, and ecological balance of Palestine. It is a monumentally depressing read, but I don't have time to go into the terrible details, but keeping with the example at hand, I'm briefly going to touch on water. The article described Israel as a, quote, galvanized civilization that created water from nothingness, where a few miles away, water disappeared and civilizations crumbled. In fact, in its first years of establishment, Israel began water diversion projects and overpumping from rivers and tributaries to serve Zionist settlements with unsustainable European standards, which were utterly in conflict with the local terrain and which set the stage for a multitude of environmental disasters all across Palestine. One example, among many, of Israel's destruction of Palestine's natural water systems is the Al-Arja River, which Israel renamed as the Yarkon. It was a vigorous coastal river described in an 1891 travel guide as, quote, a roaring river that zigzags until falling into the sea. Its power turns mills, and small fish can be caught in it. In a mere decade of Israeli management of Palestine's water, this life-giving river was reduced to a trickle of sewage, its water siphoned and replaced with a toxic sludge of industrial and domestic pollutants, which, in 1997, ate through the lungs and vital organs of athletes competing in the Maccabiah Games, when a bridge fell and they fell into the river. One of Israel's first water projects when it conquered the rest of Palestine was to divert as much water as possible from the Jordan River once it gained access. This spurred Syria and Jordan to follow suit to preserve their own share of regional waters. And decades later, water levels are so low that the Jordan River can no longer replenish the Dead Sea. The declining water levels, coupled with Israel's evaporation ponds to extract minerals and other industrial activities, have created an environmental disaster never before seen in Palestine. It has become cliche to say that the Dead Sea is dying. In the 1950s, Israel drained Palestine's Hula wetlands, a regional biodiversity treasure, in order to establish Jewish settlements. Hundreds of such colonial projects have greatly denigrated the rich biological and geographical diversity that once thrived in that terrain where three continents meet. Some of the fish and birds that were destroyed by this project were found nowhere else in the world and have since gone extinct. This is to say nothing of the way that the land has been scarred and disfigured, hilltops decapitated for rapacious settlements, millions of imported fast-growing trees planted to conceal destroyed Palestinian villages, only for these non-native trees to be rejected by the land in massive forest fires, leaving a scorched earth on hundreds of thousands of acres. And it is to say nothing of the systematic ways in which Israel uproots olive trees and other fruit-bearing trees that sustain Palestinian families. There are countless such examples and systematic ways in which Israel has devastated nature, sometimes in ways that cannot be undone. And although Israel's role as a destroyer of Palestinian society overshadows their environmental record, Israel should nonetheless be counted among the world's polluters, decimators of trees, and spoilers of nature. I want to turn now to Israeli innovations and exports, because Israel leads the world in several niche death, surveillance, and suppression technologies and tactics. It is well known and admitted by Israeli weapons manufacturers that they test their weapons on Palestinians, and Gaza is their biggest laboratory. According to Daryl Lee of the University of Chicago, Gaza is a, quote, space where Israel tests and refines various techniques of management, continuously experimenting in search of an optimal balance between maximum control over territory and minimum responsibility for its non-Jewish population. I told you earlier that Israel is right there with Saudi Arabia, leading the world in military spending per capita. Other countries like the United States, Russia, and China aren't far behind. But where an extraordinary difference emerges is with military exports. Studies and international databases will show that Israel is anywhere from the fourth to the eighth largest exporter of arms. And this depends on the year and the currency examined. I should point out, however, that these data are likely gross underestimations because Israel doesn't actually report its arms deals, many of which occur through covert deals via independent arms hustlers, often retired Israeli military generals. Given that Israel is listed among exporters of arms with far bigger populations and far bigger economies, I looked for data to show exports per capita, and I came up mostly empty-handed, to my surprise. I'm sure that data must be out there somewhere, but I couldn't find it. So I put on my old scientist and statistician hat and did the calculations myself. I used two databases. The first was of the top arms exporters in U.S. dollars for years 2010 to 2018 from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, which compiles data on arms transfers and conflicts around the world. Then, using Excel functions, I matched those data up with a world population database for corresponding years from the World Bank. Then, using simple arithmetic functions, I calculated and graphed arms sales, normalized to the size of the population to determine arms export per capita for all the countries in the SIPRI database. And what I found is that Israel leads the entire world in arms exports, often by a huge margin every single year between 2010 and 2018, with the exception of 2011, in which Sweden, strangely, was neck and neck with them. Again, these data do not include the vast covert arms transfers, military training, and surveillance technology. One of Israel's biggest military hardware niches is drones. Over 60% of global drones exports come from Israel. And the United States is just in second place with just less than 24%. The attractiveness of Israeli arms is that they boast of being combat tested. A case in point is Israel's Hermes 900, which was still in the testing phase when it was used against civilians in Gaza in 2014. A mere 3 weeks after that onslaught in Gaza that murdered 2,200 people and maimed tens of thousands more, Israel held a drone trade show called Israel Unmanned Systems 2014 in which that Hermes 900 was all the rage for its so-called performance in Gaza. In that assault in 2014, Israel used drones to kill at least 840 people. In the current assault on Gaza protesters, Israel is using a series of new drones called the Cyclone Riot Control Drone System. It's being used to spray aerosol and gas substances from the sky. They appear to be used for the first time against the Great March of Return. The company that makes the Cyclone claims on their website to be a leading supplier for police in the United States, and they boast that their product claims are based on practical field experience. So what happens after these death and suppression technologies are developed and tested on the bodies, psyches, and spirits of Palestinians? Throughout its short history, Israel has been one of the most dependable suppliers of weapons to pariah regimes, especially in situations where weapons embargoes were put in place due to severe human rights abuses. The ones I'm going to show you were revealed due to leaks, revolutions, or specific investigations, especially those by two Israeli human rights activists, Itay Mack and Yair Aron. In South Sudan's civil war, Israel continued to supply the South Sudanese regime with weapons despite an ongoing civil war that had left 500,000 people dead and 4 million displaced in the past 5 years. Israel's arms sales to South Sudan continued despite a UN report that documented extensive and grave human rights violations, including the drafting of child soldiers, burning of villages, systematic rape, indiscriminate killing, pillaging, and destruction of infrastructure. And they continued to supply weapons to them despite a U.S. arms embargo, followed by a UN arms embargo against South Sudan. In fact, just a few months ago, the former head of the Israeli Army's operation was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department as an agent who sold over $150 million worth of weapons under the cover of an agricultural company that was supposed to be building affordable housing in South Sudan. In the Bosnian massacres, Israel sold weapons to Serbian forces during the Bosnian War in the early 90s, long after the UN embargo was declared in 91. In 92, when Slobodan Milosevic was on trial, the president of Serbia at the time, he was described at the time as the new Hitler of Europe. I think most of us in this room are old enough to remember him. At that time, Israel opened an embassy in Serbia. And simultaneously, Serbian forces were creating concentration camps and committing massacres against Bosnian Muslims that led to the murder of an estimated 250,000 people. Itay Mack, whom I mentioned earlier, gathered evidence that Israelis in the highest offices were involved in both arming and training Serbian forces. Mack and Oran then petitioned the Israeli Supreme Court with concrete evidence of this, including the diary of Ratko Mladic, who's on trial at the ICC for war crimes. They had his diary in which he cataloged all the training and weapons that were transferred to them. Israel's high court rejected the petition, arguing that declassifying documents exposing Israel's role in the Bosnian genocide would harm Israeli interests. Adding insult to injury, Israel is now engaged in revising the history of this genocide. So, Israel supplied weapons to Serbia while it was known that they were committing genocide and while there was a UN embargo, arms embargo in place. And Israel's high court covered it all up. In Myanmar, We know that Israel continued to transfer weapons to the Burmese army long after they were accused of committing war crimes, including murder, rape, torture, and the burning of villages that left thousands dead and at least 700,000 displaced from the Rohingya minority. Israel was selling arms to Myanmar well after the European Union and the United States imposed an arms embargo on the country. Mack and Oran petitioned the Israeli High Court to stop these weapon sales, but the ruling was kept classified. But we know that Israel continued to supply armored land and water vehicles and artillery to the Burmese military. So, once again, Israel supplied arms to Myanmar while it was known that they were committing ethnic cleansing and while there was a UN embargo in place, and Israel's high court helped to cover it up and enable it. In Rwanda, going back again to the 1990s, to another horrific genocide, an estimated 1 million men, women, and children were massacred in Rwanda in the space of 100 days. It is said to be the fastest pace of genocide in human history. Israel provided the rifles, ammunition, and grenades that made it all possible. Itay Mack, again, in petitioning the Israeli High Court to declassify the arms transfers, quoted the Israeli arms dealer who in Rwanda said, quote, "I'm actually a doctor," unquote, expressing pride for supplying those weapons because, he said, he helped the victims die quickly. Israel's high court ruled that the details of those arms deals will remain a secret, again, claiming that it would harm Israeli interests to reveal the extent of those arms transfers. So, again, Israel supplied Rwanda with weapons while it was known that a genocide was taking place and while a UN arms embargo was in place, and Israel's high court helped to cover it up. Adding insult to injury, again, Israel later backed a move at the UN by Rwanda to rewrite history of this particular genocide as a larger quid pro quo with Paul Kagame, president of Rwanda, to take in asylum seekers deported from Israel. Now, going even further back to apartheid South Africa, this is the cover of an explosive book when it was published in 2010 by Sasha Polakasaransky, detailing the never-before-known extent of cooperation between Israel and the apartheid government of South Africa. Israel was South Africa's closest ally, its most important arms supplier, and eventually its only friend in a world that could no longer look the other way from the crimes of apartheid. The coordination between the two countries was unprecedented. Their respective intelligence chiefs held regular meetings sharing information and training and surveillance. They gave unfettered access to each other's military tactics, missions, and intelligence. Their relationship was actually deeper than mere trade and coordination. Israel had a spiritual and moral affinity for the apartheid government in South Africa, which was articulated in the 1980s by Israeli Chief of Staff Rafael Itan, who said, referring to blacks in South Africa, that they, quote, "want to gain control over the white minority, just like the Arabs here want to gain control over us. And we too, like the white minority in South Africa, must act to prevent them from taking over us." In 1976, just 2 months after Israel rolled out the red carpet for the South African president, schoolchildren in Soweto took to the streets to demonstrate against an imposed racist curriculum. The white South African police mowed them down with weapons that had been supplied by Israel. What shocked the world further from this book was to finally learn that Israel had offered to provide the apartheid government with nuclear arms as far back as 1975. Israel tried to prevent the declassification of the post-apartheid government documents, but they were unsuccessful, and it became clear that Israel did indeed lead to the nuclear armament of the apartheid regime, which luckily disarmed voluntarily following the fall of apartheid. One more thing that's worth noting here. In 2007, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warned that his country could one day, quote, face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights. And as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished. There are so many more examples of such violent Israeli subterfuge in the world. And I'm going to quickly rattle through a few of these examples without going into detail for the sake of time. But just know that every one of these instances, and this is not a complete list, of Sub Rosa arms sales occurred to bolster repressive, brutal regimes at different times, and as well as training of mercenaries to facilitate corporate plunder. Israel continued supplying arms to the former repressive white colonial regime in Rhodesia, or modern-day Zimbabwe, after UN sanctions were imposed in 1967. Israel armed and supported Portugal against national liberation movements in the former colonies of Mozambique, Angola, and Guinea-Bissau. Israel funded and trained the military repression of anti-colonial uprisings and/or dictatorships in the Ivory Coast, Central African Republic, Benin, Togo, Cameroon, Senegal, Uganda, Nigeria, and Somalia. Israel armed all sides of the Angola civil war at different times over 40 years. They used this colonial tactic in other places to fuel and arm wars to divide and reconquer Africa. Israel armed and trained elite units in Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, bolstering the brutal rule of Mobutu Sese Seko following the assassination of Pan-Africanist Patrice Lumumba. They sold arms to Sri Lanka to suppress the Tamils. Israel provided nearly all arms sold to the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua that terrorized its people for over 12 years. Following the democratic election of the Sandinistas, Israel funneled arms to the brutal Nicaraguan Contras and was embroiled in what became known as the Iran-Contra affair. They likewise sold arms to Guatemalan death squads, as well as death squads in El Salvador and Honduras, to Chile during Pinochet's horrific dictatorship, to Rafael Trujillo during his dictatorship of the Dominican Republic, to the terrorist Argentinian junta in the 1970s. In many of these places, Israel also sold surveillance technology to monitor phones and track political activists. They did the same thing in the Philippines during the Ferdinand Marcos era and in Indonesia under the repressive Suharto. They're also now supplying weapons to the accused war criminal leader of Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte. In Cameroon, Israeli generals provide training and arms to protect dictator Paul Biya, who has been crushing political dissidents, disappearing, assassinating, and torturing activists. They're doing the same thing in the oil-rich Equatorial Guinea, colluding with Obiang Nguema and ExxonMobil to suppress political dissent and facilitate the siphoning of that nation's resources to enrich its rulers and U.S. And Israeli corporations while its people languish in abject poverty. Israel also provides countries and corporations with wares and training for domestic policing and suppression of dissent. In places like Brazil, Israel plays a huge role in the domestic surveillance, prisons, militarized borders, and internal policing and suppression. In the United States, there is widespread training of U.S. police departments. The export of Israel's brutal tactics to the United States has been so alarming that Jewish Voice for Peace launched a dedicated campaign called Deadly Exchange to fight against it and bring awareness. Over 200 police and security agencies across the United States have gone on training junkets to Israel. And I think these are just the ones that are funded by one domestic Zionist agency, where they are both brainwashed about Israel and instructed in ruthless military tactics. The impact of this cooperation between U.S. domestic police departments and the Israeli occupation military came to light after the Ferguson uprising, in which RoboCop police showed up in military gear to suppress unarmed, peaceful protesters. It turned out that the Ferguson Police Department had gone on one of these training junkets in Israel. Also of note is the incident of police shooting in 2016 in Dallas, Texas, in which Police Chief David Brown sent in a robot packed with explosives to kill the suspect. It was a kind of robot suicide bomber, if you will. It was apparently the first known time that police dispatched a robot to kill a suspect on U.S. soil rather than attempting apprehension or negotiating surrender. As it turned out, that police chief had been on a 10-day so-called anti-terrorism training in Israel. Lastly, on this point, and this is something that Ali Abu Nu'ma touched on earlier, is the recent revelation that Israeli intelligence companies have been spying on U.S. citizens, not to mention the role that these Israeli intelligence companies have had in tampering with the U.S. presidential election in 2016, as the Mueller investigation has revealed. Now I want to move on to friendships and alliances. Despite claiming to be the guardians and protectors of Jews Israel, Israel actually has courted some of the world's most notorious anti-Semites, as long as they support Israel's occupation and by their arms. John Vorster, the apartheid South African prime minister that I mentioned earlier, was a Nazi sympathizer who was imprisoned by the British for his ties to the Grey Shirts fascist militia. In 1976, Yitzhak Rabin heaped praise on him and gave him the red carpet welcome when he visited Israel. Israel has cozied up and is supporting ultra-nationalist, ultra-right, anti-minority, racist, homophobe Bolsonaro in Brazil, who said, quote, "Refugees are the scum of the earth." He told a female colleague she was too ugly to rape. He threatened to destroy or imprison his political opponents. He spoke favorably of torture. He lamented that the Brazilian cavalry wasn't as efficient as Americans who exterminated the Indians. And he said that he'd rather see his son die in a car crash than hear he was gay. Israel has also developed ties and has been arming and training neo-Nazis in the Ukraine. Israel likewise opened its doors to anti-Semitic Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, who praised his country's World War II era leadership that presided over the mass murder of Jews. And he employed terrible age-old anti-Semitic tropes to demonize George Soros. In December, Netanyahu even met with him to negotiate the opening of a revisionist Holocaust museum in Budapest, which basically exonerates Hungary's role in Europe's Holocaust. Netanyahu signed a joint declaration with the right-wing Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki, which likewise wipes clean Poland's record in Europe's Holocaust and rewrote history to state that the Poles were actually helping Jews escape Nazis. Of course, there's this card-carrying anti-Semite that Israel loves and embraces. Netanyahu went so far as to make excuses for Hitler, claiming in 2015 that Hitler wasn't the monster we all thought he was, rather that it was a Palestinian leader, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who convinced him to actually kill European Jews. Luckily, Netanyahu crossed a line with that one, and European leaders and historians rose together to give them a foul card. The last bit I want to touch on briefly has to do with the way that Israel's rewriting of history is robbing the world of archaeological treasures and important history that belongs not only to Palestinians, but to all of humanity. Because Palestine is an extraordinarily special place. While it already has an indigenous population that formed there over millennia, Palestine holds a history that belongs to all people of monotheistic faiths. Since its inception, Israel has worked tirelessly to erase the footprints of the many civilizations, religions, and peoples who existed in that land before, during, and after Jewish presence in the land. The existence of so many churches and mosques are particular irritants to Israel, and it has worked in earnest to destroy, desecrate, or control them from the beginning of their control over the land. Immediately after the Nakba, Israel began a campaign of destroying the Palestinian villages it had just depopulated, including tearing down mosques and churches, some of which were centuries old and of great religious and historic significance, like the Sheikh Eid Mosque in Jerusalem that was built by one of Salah ad-Din's sons. In places where new Jewish inhabitants took over Palestinian towns, new Jewish places of worship have been turned non-Jewish places of worship have been turned into nightclubs, animal pens, restaurants, brothels, and the like. Other mosques were made inaccessible, declared closed military zones, leaving them derelict. When the Islamic movement once helped a group of internal refugees from the former village of Sadafund restore their mosque in 2000, it was bulldozed overnight in still unexplained circumstances. Increasingly, Jewish militias are vandalizing and burning churches and mosques without any consequence to perpetrators. In 2010, a U.S. State Department report stated that, quote, non-Jewish holy sites in Israel do not enjoy legal protection because the government does not recognize them as officially holy sites. After Jewish settlers torched a mosque in 2012, former military chief of staff admitted in a radio interview that there was no interest in catching the culprits. He said, quote, if we wanted, we could catch them. And when we want to, we will, unquote. Part and parcel of Israel's erasure of history, they have also targeted non-Jewish cemeteries. The ancient Muslim cemetery of Ma'manillah, which includes graveyards by prominent Muslim scholars, generals, and companions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was destroyed to build a museum by the California-based Wiesenthal Center. In 2008, over 100 skeletons were unearthed and tossed aside during excavations for the construction work. Throughout Palestine, in places where Israel has developed Jewish cities, Muslim and Christian cemeteries were simply dug up and built over. For example, Tel Aviv University, which was built over the Palestinian village of Sheikh Muniz, desecrated a graveyard and built a dormitory over it. Lastly, I want to briefly touch on the ways that Israel has weaponized archaeology. On the pretense of digging for history, it has confiscated and demolished whole Palestinian neighborhoods. Silwan in East Jerusalem is the best known example of this, where Israel has confiscated at least 6 dunams of land belonging to one family, the Siam family, and they've evicted over 6,000 Palestinians. The purpose of the dig was never about archaeology because we know that they're planning to build a so-called Jewish national park in the area, a kind of Jewish Disneyland as it's being referred to. We also know that the Israel Antiquities Authority has destroyed several ancient archaeological sites and antiquities as a result of this dig, including a cemetery dating back to the Abbasid Caliphate, and relics dating back to the Canaanite era in the second millennium BC. It is not for love of archaeology or history. In fact, Israel routinely destroys ancient cities unearthed by archaeologists, so long as they have nothing to do with Jewish history. The first thing they did when they conquered Palestine, the rest of Palestine in 1967, was to demolish the entire Moroccan neighborhood that was over 800 years old, displacing hundreds of Palestinians. Israel has engaged in such massive destruction of antiquities consistently and systematically. Another example shown here is a recent find of a 1,200-year-old mixed village of well-off Muslims and Christians who lived together. Archaeologists got a chance to take photos and record some of the relics, but the site is set to be bulldozed for development. Again, these are all just surface surveys of hidden realities. The depredations of Israel are much more vast, deeper, and far-reaching. But my hope is that what I have presented here today will expand the view from Israel as an apartheid nation suppressing the indigenous Palestinian population to a deeper understanding of Israel as a global force of violence, plunder, paranoia, surveillance, greed, war, suppression, ecological destruction, erasure of history, the forceful transfer of wealth from the weak to the powerful, and the entrenchment of supremacist ideologies that set human hierarchies and castes. No matter how many gay pride marches they hold or how many Eurovisions they host, no matter how good their national orchestra makes you feel when they tour the world, or how Palestinian citizens are given a symbolic vote, no matter how much greenwashing, pinkwashing, or whitewashing hasbara there is in mainstream media, the way that Israel exists in the world is ultimately antithetical to life and to liberty, not just for Palestinians, but for all people who struggle against tyranny, oppression, white supremacy, and ecological destruction. The situation is dire and desperate for our families in Palestine. The grim reality of our compatriots' daily lives and the dimming of our future in our homeland is portended by Israel's push now to ban the Adhan over Jerusalem for the first time since the dawn of Islam. And Israel is moving forcefully against Al-Aqsa, perhaps the final frontier in Palestine. But I do not want to end on such a hopeless note, because despite everything, there is so much to celebrate, so much to encourage our continued struggle, and much to inspire hope. In fact, I believe that Israel's current escalation of their ongoing ethnic cleansing is in many ways a desperate, though counterproductive, response to the growing international repudiation of them, including by young Jews whose moral compass is not guided by Zionism. The conversation is changing here and around the world. Palestine is the single issue splitting leftist movements and parties globally. The Democratic Party here in the U.S., the Women's March, the Labor Party in the U.K. Increasingly, we are not alone. Points of intersection with liberation and with liberation movements around the world are being filled with reciprocal solidarity. And more importantly, our people on the front lines have not given up, and they continue every day to fight and insist on life. And in the bigger picture afforded by historical examples, Palestine actually follows time-tested trajectories of liberation. Difficult and bloody as these paths always are, I believe that ultimately, restoration to our homeland, to liberty and dignity, is our only collective destiny. Thank you.
That was Susan Avalawa speaking at a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
To BCFM's Politics Show with retired international relations lecturer and author Ron Mandel and me, Tony Gosling. BBC One's Double Bluff Jill Dando 20-year tribute this week was an insult to her memory. Throwing their hands up saying, oh, well, what can we do? An attempt to exonerate the police who fitted up a man with learning disabilities, just as if the BBC had given a whole programme just to spread the views of the detectives who fitted up the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6. Tonight we make a real attempt to do Jill justice by looking at the reason she may have been killed, the motive, and those who had the means and opportunity, an alleged group of hired killers in Hungary who confessed the crime to a Buckinghamshire engineer and, he says, offered to kill three police he was in a long legal dispute with for $10,000 apiece, boasting the Dando murder as proof they could do the job. Also, the 1MDB scandal in Malaysia, £4.5 billion stolen by the Prime Minister in collaboration with Goldman Sachs, allegedly. The big banks putting their own people in power. And allegations of fascism being back in Europe, particularly in the East, and Brussels turning a blind eye in Ukraine. Not that they're part of the EU yet. Also, the Saudi nuclear reactor is nearing completion. Very little talk about that in the news here. And finally, Christian Zionists hate pastors in the United States. What are they saying to encourage the killing of Muslims? And words of encouragement for Israeli politicians from them too. We hear from the Israeli Security Cabinet, Moshe Kalon, secretive finance minister. What does he have to say about the Israeli state's biblical history and their rights? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week, retired surgeon David Halpin explains what's happened to the NHS over the last 50 years. And he's also an expert on the suspicious 2003 death of government scientist David Kelly, who coined the term dodgy dossier before he was found dead in the Oxfordshire woods. We also hear from a Bristol vegan mum who was told by NatWest Bank that all vegans should be punched in the face, so she rather spectacularly hit back. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But we're joined on the line, I hope, by investigative journalist Don Hale. Hi, Don. Can you hear me?
Hello, Tony. Yes, I can. Thanks.
Can you tell us how you first came across the Jill Dando case and, you know, what context that was?
Well, I came across it. I used to do some work with the BBC, and I was contacted by a few of her former colleagues, basically, who worked in London with her, and they were quite concerned that she had been bumped off deliberately because of a probe into a potential paedophile ring that was operating within the BBC. This was supposed to be involving quite a few sort of big stars in the sort of the wake of the Jimmy Savile.
Okay, I better ask you, first of all, was this a ring which was just inside the BBC, or did it have tentacles outside, do you know?
Well, I mean, I've dealt with things regarding the Westminster paedophile, and I think there were sort of overlaps there and people that were sort of semi-involved, people that were being interviewed on the BBC. But this was primarily as a BBC investigation that was going on. There was a number of people that were allegedly paedophiles there, and some of the staff were quite concerned when they raised concerns to the management. Jill was obviously a very well-known person there. She was the person that everyone went to with their own problems, and so she became sort of a focal point for compiling information about some of this.
Now, I think I ought to remind listeners that this was a long time before the death of Jimmy Savile, former BBC presenter, which was in 2011. So we're talking about something like 12 years before Savile died. So that, you know, there would have been still live efforts to protect Savile.
Yes, I think there were. I mean, he seemed to be a protected man. A lot of people knew what he was up to, or the allegations that they knew what he was up to. But everyone was sort of stood back, and he seemed to grope quite a few of the women in the lift or in different parts of the building there, and seemed to get away with it. And if they did report it to management, they just basically told to ignore it. But I mean, one particular lady who came to me, she was actually, you know, following Jill's death, she was actually frightened to death herself that she would be a target on that if she sort of raised her head and spoke out on this. And this seemed to be a point of at least two other people there who made contact with me. I mean, they said that Jill compiled a list of the complaints, but they said, well, she wasn't an investigative journalist herself. She was just a presenter. And she passed the information on to her next in line. And they gave it back to her, said, you know, they didn't want to touch it with a barge pole. Nobody wanted to know. That was the issue coming out. And this lady came to me, she said, I do remember she then gave the whole file to senior management at the BBC and she didn't hear any more back. But a lot of people said, you know, they didn't want to risk their careers by making official complaints and statements against individuals there because they felt they would lose the job. And as it seemed at the time, you know, the male bosses just seemed to want to ignore it. So what they said that the best thing to do was just to keep your head down and, you know, try to go somewhere else with a colleague so that you wouldn't be abused, you wouldn't be assaulted yourself, and you wouldn't be threatened if you were, you know, considered bringing some of this out to management.
So as someone who various of these people has come to talk, Don, I wonder if, you know, you can paint for us a picture of what you think Jill was concerned about and what was going on at the BBC in the 1990s.
Well, I think she was quite concerned that there was a lot of sort of sexual harassment going on at the BBC. Jimmy Savile a lot of people seemed to know that he was a paedophile. He was a groper, a sex attacker of himself. And various women had spoken out against him. Various complaints had been made against him, but they were just totally ignored because he seemed to be such a powerful person. And the image that was put across is that he was doing good work as helping out at hospitals and charity work and all that. And he was almost like Jill, the opposite face of the BBC at the time. So nobody dare risk upsetting him and some of his associates. And it seemed to be a crazy situation where everybody just seemed to look the other way and basically just told the woman, you know, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything about it, just get on with your work. You know, Savile was known there as they quoted to me, a dirty old perv. Everybody seemed to know what he was at. But again, they were sort of saying that there were links to, you know, people like the special branch, that he got friends in high places and he got a sort of a protection unit. And so nothing really came out of that. And it was only, you know, after he died that a lot of things sort of came to the forefront.
Was there any evidence that Jill was continuing to push for some sort of investigation, even after her manager or producer or whoever handed the papers back to her and said, I'm not touching this with a barge pole?
Well, yeah, she was pushing with a number of people. I gather she approached a couple of MPs to put a complaints across and sort of see where they can go from that. And I know that she did speak to at least one senior police officer at the Met. And again, he was sort of really pushing away from that, saying, you know, something he didn't want to get involved with. It was too much of a hot potato. And just, again, you know, just ignore it and get on with your job.
I mean, surely there's got to be some sort of complicity within the top ranks of the BBC. I find it incredible. I mean, how do you think that it was? It just the whole thing was just stifled of something such a serious criminal offence. I mean, we're talking about people being put away potentially for anything up to life for here, certainly for decades and possibly scores of people, and yet nobody wanted to know. That sounds difficult to believe, Don.
Well, it does. I mean, when you look at it now in the cold light of day, you know, yes, it does seem very difficult to believe. But, I mean, I've dealt with sex offences, these sort of cases going back, you know, up to 30 years or more, really. And I faced the same sort of problem when people came to me with allegations, similar allegations like this. The police just did not want to get involved, particularly if it was a person of prominence, you know, a VIP or whatever. Especially then they would start pulling faces. And they put restrictions on it that even if somebody had complained, they could only maybe go back maybe 6 years or 10 years or something like that if it was a child sex abuse or whatever. And so it meant that the police couldn't really, or certainly didn't want to investigate something if it was beyond out of that sort of remit of time. And I think the same thing sort of applied within the BBC, that a lot of people that were coming in were big names, big star name people. And again, the, you know, BBC management probably didn't want to rock the boat and upset these people. But a lot of things just went by the way at that time. You know, now we do take it very seriously, and a lot of things are acted on pretty damn quickly. But in those days, it was really a question of just, I say, keep your head down and forget about it. Get on with your job.
Did any of your sources suggest, in their minds, that there may have been some link to the murder?
Well, yes. So one particular lady who came to me, this is quite a few years after Jill's death, but she'd retired since then, but it sort of preyed on her mind, and she thought that, again, if she spoke out about this, she could be the next target. She actually said to us that, you know, Jill and some other senior people there had been threatened, literally death threats about this, if they spoke out. Now, you know, is it coincidence that, you know, a few years later then she is shot dead? I don't think, you know, I think this was a professional killing as well, I must add. I don't think it was just a casual accident or whatever. You know, people like Barry George was arrested for it later. I worked on that case for about 3 years. And it's pretty obvious that he was not capable of planning or carrying out that sort of operation. It had to be done by more or less a specialist assassin.
So why on earth was he convicted?
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, he was just convicted on a circumstantial evidence, a minute particle of gunpowder resin. When I worked on this case, I mean, the first thing I was told was to try and look at how he was convicted and to try and sort of, you know, discredit that sort of evidence. And it was quite easy to do it. We brought an expert in who said that resin could have come from even an HGV, a firework, or the fact that he spent a lot of time sort of roaming the streets. He could have sat next to somebody on a bus or on a tube. It could have been transferred quite easily. But what we found out I went actually door knocking and round the streets to try and talk to people and whatever, and everyone was sort of saying the same, you know, Barry's been fitted up for this one. And we had the local vicar who came to me and said that when Barry was arrested, and bearing in mind this was a high-profile murder and she was shot dead on a doorstep, the police said that there were no armed officers involved in his arrest or the search of his home. That was their statement. And the vicar came to me and he said that he's most concerned about it. And he said basically the police were telling Porky's here that he saw the police at Barry George's property and they were armed. And so that innocently could have been transferred from one of the officers who, if they'd been involved, handling firearms, that particle could have been transferred to his coat. But
hey, Don, that just reminds me, sorry to intervene there, but how important it is for journalists to get off their seats and out of their production offices or their newsrooms and actually walk the streets, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely, because, you know, the information is out there and, you know, same with suspicious characters and unusual cars hanging around, the whole thing. I mean, I was amazed when I was going round there about 2014, and people were coming out with all sorts of information that the police hadn't even bothered to follow up. You know, once they got Barry George in his sights, that was it. It was shut down. And so many important leads were just ignored. And I was talking with John O'Connor, who was the head of the flying squad, and he was absolutely adamant that a number of excellent leads into the shooting had just been totally ignored. He got a very, very good lead, a tip-off from one of his contacts, and he says it was an excellent lead that was ignored by the Met, and he said the Met did absolutely nothing with it. It was quite clear, in his opinion, quite clear that it was a professional hit by a trained assassin. And he said it was according to him, he believed it was a state-sponsored execution, not just a, you know, random shooting. It was an execution for whatever reason. And he said these people, you know, know what they're doing, and they are highly trained assassins. And this guy was obviously one of the same. Now, I mean, the odd thing with this, when I was going around the streets, people were saying to me, well, Barry wasn't even wearing a coat like the three-quarter length coat that was supposed to be found with this resin on that day. It was quite a mild sort of day, and he's wandering around in a T-shirt. So how did the resin get on that if he wasn't even wearing it on the day of the shooting? You know, but there's a whole range of things. I mean, we found out as well that this particle, again, could have been transferred by another way. This Barry's coat and some of his clothing should have gone straight to the forensic lab for testing. And for whatever reason, the allegation was that the photographic studio was nearer than the forensic lab. So it went to the photographic studio first, was photographed, and then went on to the forensic lab. And just a day or so before, that same photographic lab had been photographing some other evidence that had been related to a gun-related crime. So again, it gave an option that, again, that particle could have been transferred accidentally onto his coat at that time.
Well, look, going back to the BBC, you know, with these people that have come to you, how can you be sure that they're actually credible witnesses and not just feeding you a line, Don?
Well, I mean, we did have... there were several other presenters. There was presenter Liz Kershaw and Miriam O'Reilly. They both made allegations of sexual harassment at the BBC, and Sally Jones spoke about Jimmy Savile, who was later exposed, as we know, as a paedophile and serial sex attacker, and she said that he tried to grope her in a lift. And when Sally went to Jones, she told him all about her experiences with Savile, etc. And she said, well, you know, management just say, don't just ignore him. We know he's a dirty old perv. So it's a question of what could she do? So Jill did compile quite a comprehensive list, I gather, of all the allegations from other women there about Savile and about other people who were allegedly in this ring. I don't think it's a massive ring. I think it was just, well, from what this other lady was saying, you know, maybe six or eight sort of high-profile persons of interest that were, you know, stars at the time at the BBC.
So are we talking about, you know, the management simply facilitating this paedophile ring?
Well, just turning a complete blind eye to it, you know, for whatever reason. Whether these people were, you know, highly paid and big stars that they wanted to keep, or they just didn't sort of, you know, believe it or have enough credible evidence from other people to say what was what.
And what about people close to Jill Dando in the case? I wonder if you know what they made of this week's TV documentary, which was fronted by D.I. Hamish Campbell, the guy that fitted up Barry George and completely failed to do a proper investigation.
Well, I've had quite a few people on to me because I've sort of written a few things and did the investigation into Barry's case, and everybody's quite appalled about this. It was so biased and one-sided, it was unbelievable. I mean, it came across almost as if, you know, Hamish Campbell was the best thing since sliced bread. And this was an absolute disaster, really, for the Met. It was a most humiliating defeat for them in terms of... Neil Everybody's Dog was sort of saying that Barry George was not the man to do it. And, I mean, John O'Connor, say, for the ex-Flying Squad man, said, you know, there was conflict within his own investigations unit. People were telling him that the majority of people, you know, thought that Jill Dando's murder was the work of a professional hitman.
I mean, why didn't those other death threats against BBC presenters, why didn't they come out at the trial?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think one was against Tony Hall, who's now the big chief there, one death threats there. But there were at least three death threats, and one at least was noted and recorded against Jill Dando at the time. I think only a matter of a week or 10 days before she was shot dead. And I think the Met were certainly told about it. And as far as I can recall, I mean, I'm, you know, talking a few years ago now when I did the investigation, but as far as I know, the main emphasis was to protect the management of BBC because they thought they were the more likely targets than one of the presenters. But I, you know, say looking at the information I had at the time, I would have thought it would have been the opposite way around in terms of, you know, Jill was the face of the BBC. She was on Crime Watch, she was on holiday programmes, she was everywhere. You know, the smiley person from the BBC. And I think, you know, she would have been the more obvious target, in my opinion, rather than some, say, unknown face as a management person at the BBC.
Well, these management people, of course, are all state employees. And you were saying about the special branch chief saying that it could be a state-sponsored assassination. I mean, basically, they're part of it, essentially. I wonder if it's possible for the police to investigate properly any kind of state-sponsored assassination. Surely the idea is if the state are going to kill someone, they're going to make sure there's no investigation.
Well, I can't understand why they didn't follow up on a number of leads. And, I mean, several officers I've spoken to over the years here have all said the same thing, that there was a massive amount of information came in. And, you know, that's possibly some excuse that Hamish Campbell used in terms of, you know, they were swamped with a lot of leads and information coming in. Yes, I give them part of that. But there was a lot of very, very highly credible information that came in. I mean, when I went round, literally on the streets there, I went to the local school, just a few hundred yards or whatever from where Joe lived, and there were a lot of women there who were saying that the police had never come to question them about anything about that day. And they quite clearly said that there was a man that was there that they were concerned about because of the young children that were in the school playground that was causing concern. He was there for about 10 minutes. They described him in a very similar coat to the one that they claim Barry George was wearing, a three-quarter-length dark coat, a man of Middle Eastern appearance who was there for about 10 minutes. He took a phone call on his mobile phone and then ran off in the direction of Joe Dando's house. And the same man, the description of the same man, was then given by a number of other witnesses heading back the same way after hearing a shout or a scream or something. And again, I don't. If you saw the television programme, there was a neighbour on there saying much the same thing, that he heard a sort of a scream or something like that and saw this man, the same description, walking away. And even Hamish Campbell himself said that there was a man, a tall, dark man, walking away at fast pace from that area, and he was more likely the killer of Joe Dando. So why on earth hasn't followed that sort of lead up? That was absolutely concrete at the time, where we got at least two or three definite descriptions, which, you know, very nearly matched. And it's almost the complete opposite of people like Barry George. You know, he's not a tall, dark, well-dressed man. You know, like this. It just seems absolutely preposterous that all these leads were ignored. And so people like John O'Connor were absolutely appalled by this, that, you know, he said there was a lot of credible evidence there that was just, you know, put in the dump file, really. And once, say, they got a rest in mind with Barry George, everything else was shut down.
Well, we're in the last court of appeal here, because, I mean, it's certainly something has to be done about this, and the murder investigation reopened. Your article, Don, is called Exclusive, : Tragic Jill Dando Probe BBC Paedophile Ring. Murder TV presenter Jill Dando tried to expose a paedophile ring involving big-name BBC stars, a former colleague has claimed, and that was written by you back in July 2014. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. But another thing, I mean, you've been obviously following this ICSA, the paedophile, VI paedophile, and the National Inquiry. How do you think it's all going?
Well, I was called to give evidence at the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse 4 weeks ago today. I was there. And it's very hard going, to be honest, because I was treated like as I was on trial. I was given credible evidence against a number of individuals and saying what it was like when I was attacked by Special Branch 34 years ago, and the pressures I've had in the intervening years since not to reveal my information about these people. And I've been basically attacked and abused by people like the Met, who are trying to discredit evidence they've put forward. The IOPC put a damaging report against me at the investigation a few weeks ago, which just didn't make sense. It was absolutely riddled with errors, and I had to respond to this. And I was able to provide 46 emails to show that I could absolutely destroy their case completely. And a six-month dialogue with officers at the Met and with the IOPC that completely contradicted their claims.
But surely this is not what the National Inquiry should be about. It should be about whistleblowers and witnesses coming forward and just giving their evidence.
It should be, and that's why I thought. I got credible evidence. I've interviewed the head of the Special Branch, the head of the Flying Squad, the head of the Rochdale Police, and various others. And they're all saying the same thing at the time. When they were doing their investigations, they were trodden on. They were threatened by senior officers and told, you know, not to pursue this any further, to forget it. You know, or they'd lose their jobs and all sorts of things. And Tony Robinson, who was the special branch guy who gave me chapter and verse about things that happened in Lancashire and about various MPs and that, he said that after he gave evidence to me, he then got a phone call from the Met and from special branch threatening that he's not to talk to me at all, not to talk to any journalist at all. He could lose his he was under the Official Secrets Act. He was still supposed to be on that, although he'd retired donkeys years ago. He was still pushing that angle and saying he would lose his pension and end up in prison. And this is the sort of pressure that people are under even now. I did a radio interview with Theresa May a few years ago when she was the Home Secretary, and I put a plea in on behalf of three very credible whistleblowers, who one was MI5, one was the Met, and one was the Special Branch, who all wanted to come and give evidence against high-profile VIPs, but they wanted a guarantee in view of what had happened to the threats against Tony, that they would it would be anonymous and they would be protected. They wouldn't lose their pensions and what have you. And Theresa May refused to allow that. And the inquiry have also refused to allow a lot of other people to come forward to give their evidence at this inquiry. And so, you know, people are obviously frightened of the repercussions from this, even now. And I've been threatened. I had Northampton Police. I put a chapter and verse into the inquiry in December about what about an incident that happened with Cyril Smith in Northampton and in Birmingham in the 1980s. Now, just before I walked into the witness box, the counsel for the inquiry gave me a note saying that the Northampton Police were basically calling me a liar, and saying that they never interviewed me, either informally or formally. And I was challenged over this at the time, and I had to give what information I could at the time. And I said, look, I can answer it. If you'd asked me yesterday or whatever, I could have told you exactly who the officer was. And they tried to turn it into something that I'd just made up. Well, eventually, the following week, we got North... You know, I provided all this evidence to confirm who the officers were that came to see me, the time, the date, and a correspondence over 3 months with them. And it proved categorically that the Northampton Police had lied through the teeth. And they'd given false evidence to the independent inquiry. And in the end, they had to issue a new statement to the inquiry just on the last week, saying that, yes, they had interviewed me as part of a covert operation by the police. And the information about this, all the records about my interviews, etc., were suppressed by senior management. That was why they couldn't find any record of it. So it shows the extent that the police are going to try and discredit journalists who stand up and any other whistleblowers who are involved.
Now, you said there something about the chief constables being threatened by senior officers, but surely a chief constable is the senior officer.
Well, yeah, that's right. But they, in effect, you know, still work for the government. They are often appointed by the government, and so, you know, I suppose they want to watch the P's and Q's. But, I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. You would think it would be much easier now that everybody wants to get this out, and they all put the smiley face on it. Yes, they want to, you know, to see a way forward, etc. But when it comes to naming, if it's against Joe Bloggs the milkman or a teacher or something, that's fine. That's dealt with pretty damn quickly, and these people end up in court and what have you. If you're talking of an MP or a person of interest or whatever, then that's a different matter.
OK, how would you sum up the ICSA inquiry, the National Inquiry, the way it's operating?
Very disappointing. It's on the road to nowhere, to be honest. I can't see that they're going to come up with anything substantial. So many people have been refused access to this inquiry, and so many people with genuine evidence are just being pushed away.
Now, I've also noticed that Harvey Proctor, I put this to Mark Watts last week, that Harvey Proctor, who's a convicted sex offender, he's been given status as a core participant, which has really dismayed a lot of people who were considering complying with and going along to the inquiry.
Well, that's right. I mean, there were about 20 core participants there at this inquiry. I mean, it's quite a hostile atmosphere. I mean, I was in that witness box for over 4 hours. I was grilled as though I was on trial. it was, really uncomfortable.
So it doesn't sound as if this is going to get to the bottom of very much at all. There might be a few little scandals that get examined. But look, Don, I know, and I chatted to you a few months ago about this, that you think that it's potential that actually the KGB, the Russians during the Cold War, have got quite a lot of information about what's been going on in Westminster.
Yes, and that was very strange. I mean, I did a book launch a few years ago, which was an investigation into cover-ups with the British government in terms of the spy Buster Crabb, and he was spying on the Russians, really. So when we went to the book launch, the Russians were there. There was a KGB colonel who, strange enough, used to live around the corner from me in Manchester working when he was undercover. And he came to me and was on about all this coverage with the paedophiles. And he said they had done various honey traps with MPs and other people of interest in terms of providing women that would they'd be able to blackmail people for information. But what they found out is most of these people that they were dealing with were not chasing young women, they were chasing young boys. And, you know, they were quite horrified about this themselves. They didn't think this was going on. And they completed quite a large file on a number of MPs that were within this paedophile ring, and they were sharing information, etc. And so, you know, it led to believe that a lot of these people were leaking information from government secrets, you know, to protect their own identity. But they were obviously more aware than possibly our own government at times as to who was involved with this sort of racket.
Don, I know you're quite a prolific writer. Whereabouts is the best place to follow your work online? And maybe you can also give us the title of some of the books you've written.
Yeah, well, I've got a new book coming out very shortly, Murder in the Cemetery, which is a massive review of the case I dealt with a few years ago, the Stephen Downing case, 27 years for murder he didn't commit. And this exposes all the cover-ups, the corruption on the case from all parties within the Home Office and wherever. That comes out, Murder in the Graveyard, by HarperCollins. That comes out in June. I've got my own website, which is 3wsdonhale.co.uk. I've written The Final Dive, which is the one I mentioned about Buster Crabb. And I've obviously written quite a few books. But if people go on to Amazon or Google, just put in the name for the books and that, everything will come up. I've written probably about 40 books or in total, but two or three bestsellers about basically about cover-ups.
What about online?
Well, I don't do a lot online nowadays because I've been tied up with doing books. There's a podcast coming out shortly, which is tied in with the book. And obviously deal with a lot of, Twitters and Facebook.
Cool. Finally, of course, it's not actually about Jill. It's also about the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, these horrendous miscarriages of justice. Even some say the alleged 7/7 bombers, some of those may not even have been in the right place at the right time. Is there anything you think we can change to make sure these miscarriages of justice are brought to a halt?
Good question, really. I think it's so difficult. I mean, there were an awful lot that happened in the sort of 70s and 80s period. Obviously, the laws have been changed from that, but it's still very difficult. I mean, the police work in opposite to what the British law is. As far as they're concerned, you're guilty until you're proven innocent. Once they get somebody in their sights, it's very, very difficult for them to prove that they weren't a certain place at a certain time. And it seems to be a fairly common thing, where I think Professor David Wilson was saying yesterday that a lot of the miscarriages that happen are typical of other miscarriages, where they pick on a fairly vulnerable person that a lot of society may not be too interested in. They may not be able to sort of give a proper alibi as to where they were, and they may be considered a bit of an oddball in that particular area or whatever, or may even have a previous sex offence. So when something happens, it's like the usual suspects are rounded up, and it's for them to try and prove their innocence, which is very, very difficult.
OK, Don Hale, investigative journalist, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Now, we're going to go on to looking more and more at the potential criminals that did kill Jill. And to do that, I spoke to an engineer from Buckinghamshire. His name is Jerry Coulter. He also submitted evidence. He's one of those people who submitted some of that avalanche of evidence that was submitted to the police about who he believes was behind killing her.
Well, 96 is when the car got stolen, and I think this probably happened.
He starts by talking about how he had his car stolen, and the police actually were complicit in this car being stolen, and he started to do a long, long litigation against the police down in Dorset because they wouldn't help him get his car back, even though he'd spotted it on the showroom forecourt.
Published on Vomit that I had lawyers that weren't getting anywhere and that the police were ignoring, and that there were police of misconduct, and the only people that are charged with investigating it is the police authority and the very coppers that are involved in keeping the lid on it all. And all this was being published. So that's when these people came into contact with me, and they actually predicted you're just going to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds in civil litigation and basically get nowhere and be very dissatisfied. But, and this was the caveat, when I met the chap in Budapest, for £10,000 per pop, they would knock off three of them for me. The deputy chief constable that was the main protagonist, the clerk of the police authority, and the new chief constable coming in, who all three of them, because the clerk to the police authority and the new deputy chief constable, had all had meetings with me, lawyers, letters and everything. I'd had meetings with the chairman of the police authority and everything. So everyone knew I was making criminal allegations, even through my MP, to the then PCA, Morehouse, of the police authority. Complaints authority. Everyone knew what my allegations were. It was that the deputy chief constable facilitated the theft of my Jeep and was told, long before the car dealer even said that he'd had a break in his yard, and hey presto, guess which car is nicked? Mine, the one with an order on it to be returned. You know, long before that happened, all this was documented with lawyers' letters, and the fact that they were pushing it into civil litigation. These were criminal allegations being made by London lawyers against high-ranking coppers for hanky-panky over a stolen car. No wonder there was only one way to go for them, that was to the wire. And so these mercenaries were prepared to go to the wire as well. They were saying to me that, sit there so far outside the law, the only way you'll get a resolution is to go out there with them. You employ us. For £30,000, we'll get you satisfaction.
They were threatening to murder these three.
Yes, at £10,000 each. The only reason I met them, the only reason I met these people in Budapest was because I didn't want mercenaries knocking on my door in Hertfordshire. When I met this guy in a flat in Budapest and I saw what they exactly were what they were. These were typical what looked like squaddies with crew-cut haircuts. Most of them were Russian, although Petrikov purported to be Hungarian.
So how many of them were there altogether?
I saw five of them, all in leather jackets and jeans. Petrikov wasn't, he was different. He wore a smart suit and a black polo neck jumper, I'll vividly remember, and had smart-looking grey hair, very suave, but at the same time, he claimed he was an ex-Hungarian paratrooper. What age was he? I'd say early 40s.
And the squaddies?
Similar sort of age.
Okay. 40s.
Early 40s.
So anyway, what evidence did they give you to say that they could actually do this job if you gave them the money?
They claimed they'd done the dando job. They kept saying we did the Jill dando job. They kept on saying this to me. In other words, you can trust us. Don't give us 30 grand straight off. Give us 10. We'll knock the first one off, you know. Then you can look at the other three over a period of time, you know. And when you've got stonewall alibis, like you're having tea with the Bishop of St Albans or something like that, you know. And the only one that spoke fluent English was this guy Petrikov, the one that was suited. All the others, well, they looked like they could storm a trench, put it this way, with an assault rifle, and that'd be about all they could
do. Well, I mean, you know your firearms, Jerry. Did you think that there was any potential link at the time?
Well, they were claiming that the other guys in the leather jackets were all, they were Russians, and they admitted to being Russians. Petrikov claimed he was Hungarian, but he spoke Russian, he spoke English, and he spoke Hungarian. And his name didn't sound particularly Hungarian to me. I believe they were what they claimed. They were a mercenary unit that were touting for work.
We now know quite a lot about the ballistics of what happened to Jill Dando. So is there anything that you think that could link to these guys?
Yes. They claim she was shot with a Tokarev pistol. Now, Tokarevs and AK-47s were relatively unknown in this country at that time until the Polish lorry drivers and everything started bringing them in and selling them to criminals here. But at that time, Warsaw Pact weapons were virtually unknown. Knowing these people and knowing they were professionals, they would have shot her with a soft lead bullet. She would not have been shot with a military full metal jacket bullet. She would have been shot with a soft point bullet or a soft lead bullet, which deforms and it flattens out and it dumps all its energy into the target. Unlike a full metal jacket bullet, which is used by military forces, which will actually go right through a body. And that is the reason why, so that if you could have casualties on a battlefield as opposed to a lot of severe terminal gunshot wounds that would take a person a long time to die. Soft lead bullets were outlawed by the Geneva Convention and still outlawed by the Hague Convention today. And so therefore, they probably would have had an awkward time matching the calibre of that bullet if she was shot with a soft point bullet. They would have, forensics would have had a lot of trouble. If they did manage to find the base of it intact, they could find out what the diameter was, and they could probably get an idea or think they could match it to a calibre. But look, for them to have matched that to a Tokarev at that time, it probably wasn't even in their mind. It wasn't even nowhere near their mindset, right? And bearing in mind, they had got a suspect that they were working on who was a person of low IQ. They've got a bullet, right, that they probably found somewhere, a soft point bullet. They haven't got the firearm that shot it, and they've got a firearm. It can't even argue a defence. And so they've set about building a case against him. Well, that is already going on. Then, after I come back from Budapest, I, of course, am not happy with the fact that the police in Dorset will not comply with the SI and have their retired deputy chief constable investigated by an outside force, and that they're forcing this into civil litigation. And I speak to a Superintendent Jeff Brazier in Dorset Police. He's the head of the Dorset Police Complaints Department. I tell him that I've spoken to people in Budapest that are telling me to stop engaging barristers and to engage mercenaries to sort it out. And I also had the same conversation, Superintendent Jill Donnell. I even tell her about this meeting with Petrikov. She just laughed in my face. She probably thought I dreamt it. I don't know what she thought. But we're a family that was an international family. We used to fly in and out of Japan. We used to fly all over the world. I was married into a Japanese wealthy family at the time. I had an open checkbook from Japan to pay for the legal fees. And she just laughed at me. When I reported to Brazier about these mercenaries, I even told him that they claimed to be the same people that shot Jill Dando. And he supposedly made a note of it. And that was, I never heard anything more. You'd have thought that someone from Hertfordshire Police or someone would have interviewed me at that time about these people that were still present in Budapest, right? But because they were working on Barry George and trying to build a case against him, no one was interested in what I was
saying.
Well,
what the police have said is that he used some sort of modified starting pistol.
I've seen various things. They also claimed, and the round that they've shown, or that I've seen pictures of them, was a 9mm Parabellum round. It's an extremely powerful handgun round. It's the same round that's fired by the German Luger and the German submachine gun, the Schmeisser machine pistol. It's an extremely powerful round. There's only one more handgun round more powerful. It's a 357 Magnum. It is an extremely powerful round, the 9mm Parabellum. The British police use it as a standard round in their Glocks and in their Heckler & Nock assault rifles. It is an extremely powerful round. They're trying to say that Barry George converted a starting pistol to fire a Parabellum round. Well, I'm sorry, you know, I have a Section 1 firearms permit. I also have a very, very high knowledge of firearms, how they work, and ballistics and ammunition and everything else. I also am a qualified engineer working in the Rolls-Royce aviation sector and power generation sector on obsolete Rolls-Royce engines, right? I have access to Rolls-Royce OEM machine shops with multi-access CNCs, heat treatments and everything else. I'm an engineer at the pinnacle of my profession with a deep understanding of firearms and engineering. I could not convert a starting pistol to fire a 9mm parabellum round. And even if you made it chamber it, it would blow up in your face or blow your hand off or whatever. You know, I couldn't do it. Most experts in firearms who really know firearms would tell you it cannot be done. But the worst thing, forget the coppers that originally had Barry George and were working on framing him. At the trial, it was the backroom boys. These people were more responsible. These people had worse misconduct than the original coppers because they went along with it. They tried to make forensic evidence fit the fit-up, if you understand what I'm saying. They tried to make it that he had done this. They had no... They couldn't.
I mean, Jerry, you say it's fitting up, but, I mean, if you've got the lead detective saying, I think this is the guy, can you look for any evidence that might corroborate this? That's what they're doing, isn't it?
But they didn't. They tried to make evidence fit what he wanted it to do, because there was none. I mean, for example, on his jacket, they supposedly found nitro spit. They called it in court firearms residue. But people like me that shoot at Bisley and things like that, firearms residue to us is the residue that's left inside a firearm in an action and inside a barrel that needs cleaning out after the gun is used, right? What spits out of the barrel and spits out the breech when you fire a shotgun, a rifle or a pistol, we call nitro spit. It's burning particles of nitro. If you come back after shooting a match, it's in your hair. You smell like an old firework. You know, you have to have a shower to clean it out. And even then, you can still smell it because it's in your sinuses. These particles of burning nitro are found everywhere. They're not just from guns, right? A cap gun will produce it. A party popper. If someone's at a party, when someone fires a party popper and fires a streamer, there'll be particles. If those particles get on your clothes, they will give the same chemical analysis as nitro spit coming
now,
out of
the I know Barry George was found to have just one tiny fragment of this.
And it could have come from a party popper, it could have come from anything. It didn't necessarily mean it was near a firearm. And had he have fired a firearm, it wouldn't be one fragment. You'd be covered in it. Your sleeve would be covered in it. Your jacket would have it.
But anyway, look, getting back to Budapest for a minute, was there anything else that convinced you that Petrikov and these guys were telling the truth?
To tell you the truth, I didn't know. All I know is they were so adamant about it, and they were so convincing that if I paid them the money, the job would be done, that they weren't going to take the cash and disappear over the horizon. And that the fact that they were claiming to have done the dando job, the fact that they were saying that was a professional job, and the reason the police will never be able to solve it is because when you employ a mercenary, a professional to do it, there is no connection between that mercenary and the person that employed him. The chain is broken. So even if they leave any forensics or human hair or any of their stuff, there is nothing, you know, they will never be found. They will never be connected. It's not, in order to connect someone, you have to have an auditable chain. In the case of employing a mercenary, he is not in any way connected to the target other than the fact that he eliminates the target.
But the thing is, you're talking to Dorset Police within, maybe months or a couple of years of the murder of Jill Dando. You're giving them information.
The investigation into Barry George was still live. It was still all live. The Dando thing had not long happened. And these were people telling me that they'd done it. They even told me the weapon that was used. I told all this to Brazier. And here's the other thing, right? All those phone calls in the Dorset Police Headquarters are recorded. They had it all. But they either didn't pass it on to the investigating officers, they didn't pass it on to Hertfordshire where I lived, no one interviewed me, because they were too busy trying to frame. But if they said to them, oh, you're covered in nitro spit, we'd go, oh, really?
Do you think the police will ever seriously pursue the Jill Dando murder? Now we know that the person that was convicted for it was not guilty.
The only person I want pursued are the officers and the forensic people that fitted up Barry George. That is what I want pursued. They knew what they were doing. Even the CPS prosecutor must have known that George didn't have the IQ or the facilities or the means to do that. All I do know is it is a very, very good likelihood that Petrikov was behind it. Seeing these people, they were definitely what they claimed to be. They were a Russian mercenary unit that operate either as a team or as individuals. The fact that he told me they used a Russian pistol to do the job, I think would add up. And also, how the police have only homed in on the fact that they, Barry George, supposedly converted a gun to fire a parabellum round, Christ knows how, just because they had to focus in on something. They had to put something in to bullshit a judge and a jury, which they did. You know, they didn't have a converted firearm. They had to prove something, so they had to sight a round. So they, what round did they choose? A standard police issue round, 9mm parabellum. Well, how the hell did he manage to convert anything to fire that? I don't know.
Well, that's, as you probably might have recognised, firearms expert and engineer Jerry Coulter. Ron, what do you make of this whole case?
Well, I just want to comment on Don Hale's extensive interview. What actually was running through my mind is how major institutions are very protective of their image and why they would not pursue any allegations about misconduct. You know, I was thinking about the police department. They didn't face institutional racism until after the Stephen Lawrence case. And that was attributed to the dogged determination by Stephen Lawrence's mother. How the Catholic Church is, for years, is shrugging off any allegations about sexual abuse.
Yeah, we've been told that they're turning the corner, aren't we?
And the BBC obviously was not taking allegations about sexual harassment seriously. That was well before the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement has actually been a turning point. You know, now,
but you're talking about turning points, but actually what he's saying is that the current inquiry is really going to get nowhere.
Yes, I'm not really surprised because, again, if they're going to take any serious allegations and they're going to pursue it, that could basically open a Pandora's box.
Or a can of worms.
Exactly right, or a can of worms. So I think they're more likely to close ranks and basically just...
the establishment protecting itself. Anyway, a couple of other announcements. We've got Bristol Transform tomorrow. Wanted to have an interview, but we had that long interview with Don Hale about that. Bristol Transformed is a sort of left-wing activist party, or kind of actually quite fun, sorts of a massive number of different types of things, like we're talking about left-wing economics, about environment and climate. That is going on from 10 a.m. tomorrow at the Malcolm X Centre and People's Republic of Stokes Croft, both ends of City Road, and also the School of Activism all over the Easter holidays at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. We'll have more on that next week, but we'll finish with Moshe Kalon, the Israeli Finance Minister, and you can comment on that afterwards, Ron.
Tonight, at Israel's 70th anniversary, it is important to say that for 67 of those years, the Israel Bonds Organization has been by our side. During that time, men and women like you in the United States and all over the world have pumped over $41 billion into Israel's economy. The powerful combination of Israel bonds and Israeli ingenuity has helped make so much possible. Your investments have been used to build the dynamic, inspiring Jewish nation. We celebrate this not just tonight, but each and every day. As finance minister, I can tell you that Israel today has a strong economy, leading the world in areas such as cyber, science, and agriculture. We have created a strong state which can defend itself against any threats. And, as you know, we have many threats in our region.
So we'll have to cut that there. But, Ron, what do you make of this chap?
Well, I think he was probably speaking the truth. I mean, the United States has not only bankrolled the Israeli economy, it's provided a record number of arms and shares intelligence, and obviously the political support that the United States provides Israel is cannot be underestimated.
But what about the sort of spiritual support, if you want, from the Christian Zionists, most of whom are in the U.S.?
The Christian Zionists, it's very interesting why they support Israel. I don't think they support Israel based on any kind of biblical notion that the Jews had a religious claim to the land of Canaan based on the Old Testament. I think the Christian Zionists have their own agenda, and they basically believe that when Armageddon comes and the second coming of Christ, people will have an opportunity to follow Jesus Christ, and that would be Christians. Non-Christians would be damned.
Well, what about this idea that the Mahdi, the hero in prophecy of Islam, is the Antichrist in Christian literature?
Well, that's very interesting. And you can... you can trace that back possibly to the Crusades and this demonization of Islam. And even to this very day, you have many people who talk about the clash of civilizations as a result of the 9/11 attacks on World Trade Center.
But it might be fueling a lot of this Islamophobia. Anyway, sorry, Ron, to cut you. We're going to have to leave it there. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to all our guests. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Our show page is thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing, enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, we feature faculty and student researchers and authors from Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. We focus on what corporate media spend their precious airtime on, rather than covering substantive, newsworthy issues. Today, we'll look at junk food news of entertainment, infotainment, blurred lines, and clickbait. On today's Project Censored Show, stay tuned.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are featuring a segment on so-called junk food news. This is a feature that Project Censored has been running in our books going back to the 1990s, and a phrase coined by founder Carl Jensen. In the 1980s, we'll talk more about the definitions, but first, let me introduce today's guests on the program. We're joined by Izzy Snow, who is a researcher and author and student at College of Marin. She contributed to Chapter 2 in Censored 2019, which is called Blurred Lines and Clickbait on Junk Food News. Izzy Snow, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
We are also joined by Christina Hamilton. She is also a researcher and author and contributor to Censored 2019 on the Junk Food News chapter. She's also a student at College of Marin in Northern California. Christina, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey.
And last but surely not least, we are joined by Dr. Susan Rahman, who is a professor of sociology, behavioral sciences at College of Marin. She is our affiliates person from College of Marin that works with Project Censored every year, both on the Validated Independent News and our first chapter for Top Stories. Also, of course, the last couple of years has been overseeing the Junk Food News chapter. And of course, Susan Rahman, among the many other things she does, she is on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation as vice president. She has also contributed to previous Censored volumes and focuses much of her research on issues surrounding Palestine. Susan Rahman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mickey. It's nice to be here.
So whichever of you likes to start and jump in, we're going to have an hour conversation about everything junk food news. So why don't we just start by telling our listeners and reminding them, what do we mean by junk food news? Izzy?
Yes. Carl Jensen created the term junk food news in 1982 as sensationalized news stories began to gain prominence. Censored 2019 notes that these were, quote, empty calorie stories that often crowded out the kind of real investigative journalism required to maintain a healthy democracy. Junk food news is news from sources that are purely devised to be entertaining and not informative. You don't really learn anything about policy or the global social issues of the world when you read them. The experience of digesting an entirety of an e-news website is the same as that rotten feeling in your stomach after gorging on an entire bag of potato chips. So experiencing it and enjoying it is a lot like eating junk food news.
Indeed. And you're reminding me of Dr. Andy Lee Roth, our associate director, co-editor of the Censored Volumes and the Censored Movie, who talked about junk food news being akin to Pringles.
Right? Yeah, you pop them back one by one and you feel sick after, but you're still hungry a few minutes later.
So now that we have this definition for junk food news, thank you, Izzy, for that definition. And of course, Susan Rahman chiming in. One of you might want to talk a little more about how have you seen this developing, given that you've been researching this, you've contributed to the Censored annual volumes from Seven Stories Press. Since Carl talked about junk food news, has this problem grown? Has it gotten worse? What are your views on this based on your research?
I definitely think that it's gotten a lot worse with proliferation of different media now with the internet and social media. It excels more and there's a lot more at stake for media outlets to actually get audiences. And instead of being about actually doing a service for the public by informing them of important news sources, is more about the money. So the business aspect of it actually makes it so that they have to chase down those like sensationalist stories to get the readership or the viewership. It could be fun. I had a whole point in my life where I loved gossip news. I loved like the E stuff, Perez Hilton, stuff like that. But it is frothy and junky and it's just escapist in a way because it doesn't really matter. The problem is when that's your only source for any kind of news. And it's so, so easy to actually funnel that in and just stay in that zone.
You know, again, we have our guilty pleasures. Some people like sports. Some people like this kind of gossip news or entertainment, right? But one of the big challenges we've seen over the last few decades is the infotainment, the blurred lines of entertainment and information, right? And it's what Neil Postman called in the mid-1980s. He was saying that we were amusing ourselves to death. Are we there yet? Susan Rahman, why don't you jump into the conversation here? Say a few words about some of the things that you teach and how you present this to your students. And again, every year we're so fortunate to have so many fantastic students that come through your classes that contribute to the book. It's not just that they're learning for their own behalf. They're sharing what they're learning and they're showing their skills in published works.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to have this experience and to meet these students who really dig into the material. This idea that we do entertain ourselves with media in one form or another, really a bulk of our day is spent in some form of tech or media looking at a screen. And so what kinds of things are people looking at? Often it is junk food. And so having students in class who understand that that is a big part of their reality, but then able to take that next kind of critical analysis and say, okay, well, this is interesting. This is everywhere I turn, I'm seeing it on my laptop. I'm hearing it on the radio. I'm seeing it on my phone. If I turn on the television, I'm seeing it there. But what is that doing for me? What am I learning as a result of this? And so that piece where maybe they're questioning that is something that I hope to get across in the classroom with them. And I think that's the critical media literacy that we do in the classes that involve Project Censored, certainly, but in terms of like critical thinking in general as part of an undergraduate education, how do students look at all of this? Because there's so much information out there, and how do we look at it? How do we decide what's important, what's meaningful? And I think a lot of the things that they're also touching on is what they're not learning by paying attention to this junk food kind of mantra that's played over and over again. And hopefully what they're learning as a result of using independent news sources then opens a door into that reality as well. I see that as a social justice tool, you know, in terms of how we understand learning more about what kind of global social issues or social problems or whatever you want to term them are out there. It's almost as if you can't fault people for not working towards change if they don't know that there's a change that needs to happen, right? And I think that junk food does a really good job of distracting people to the point where they're not looking at the other stuff. And, you know, as a Marxist sociologist, I might think that that is by design. But whether it is or it isn't, the point is that students then have an opportunity to check out. And we know what'll happen. We might even be living in some of that right now, checking out kind of reality and what happens in terms of human rights and all the things that get kind of squashed when we don't stand up and ask for what it is we think is important.
Definitely, Susan. And I think you hit on a really important point, which is that the most dangerous element of junk food news is that they turn the reader into a passive consumer. Junk food news stories are designed to protect corporate interests, and they work to slowly remove agency for the viewer. So if you empower a student with an independent news and media freedom and media literacy education, it encourages the viewer to be an active and engaged citizen. Independent news sources are not beholden to corporate interest and paint a more vivid factual picture of the current global social issues, which is key to understanding the different ways in which internet culture has influenced how we carry ourselves today and how we make decisions about the sort of society. If we're so passive that we are unable to be active in our communities, a lot of stuff goes by without us even recognizing what's going on.
To jump in there, Izzy, and build off what you're saying about passivity versus being an active consumer, I definitely noticed this with myself as well. One thing, like Mickey, you said earlier about how we're able as students to go out and share our work, not just in books and everything on the website. I'm able to talk with my family, my friends, my coworkers, to have conversations with them. And then they're like, oh yeah, like they don't know what junk food is, and I explain it like, oh, then they have five examples off the top of their heads that they could bring up. Like if it's a Kardashian or Jenner or whatever. I'd had one coworker, Paul, he actually went right on his phone on Google and he just went to the first five Google stories he saw in the news. And four of them were just straight up entertainment. One wasn't significant, but again, like he got the message like right away, which is very cool. But when I did the same thing to go on my little Chrome on my Android, what I noticed was that I didn't get any news at all. I got all like things about Netflix shows because again, you're not really aware that Chrome is so it's like using those algorithms to just keep you with what you're interested in. And again, it's like unless you're actually searching for those things, you're not going to really be aware of it. And it's so much easier just to kind of let those things go on the wayside and not seek out things.
Definitely. And I think you hit on a good point, which is that the internet culture has made it so that there are blurred lines between what junk food news is and what clickbait news is and what actual important news is. And corporate media tries to sell bite-sized news or news that waters down the complexities of nuanced topic to mere sound bites and GIFs in order to engage their viewers because we're so plugged into this internet culture. These days, we're expected to fit knowledge into an 140-character count. So it's all about the GIFs, the retweets. It becomes more about the eyeballs on the screen than the thoughts and ideas behind them.
Indeed, you just mentioned in terms of the Twitter count, I think that they doubled the characters in the last couple of years or so. So, wow, we can maybe have a 15-second idea going on, right? That's somehow celebratory. Interestingly enough, based on all of the things that you were just saying, I think, too, that this really underscores an important part of, I would say, not just critical media literacy, but civic literacy and participatory literacy, that is apparently not being taught very much in the K-12 programs, right? Susan, you might want to jump in with some of this, that we both teach community college and we teach college university level. And it's pretty amazing that the students that are coming to us, what Christina was saying a moment ago, when you're explaining to people where you work, you happen to work at a fantastic independent local bookstore.
I work at Copperfields Books.
Indeed. And we need more local independent bookstores.
We definitely do.
We surely do. A big part of community education, it's not just happening in the schools. And if it isn't happening in the K-12, unless you're lucky enough to have a teacher that brings it in, it's just not part of the standard curriculum. But this kind of nuts and bolts education is part of civic literacy that is necessary for people to grow up to understand how to be engaged and where to engage and how to choose what's important to them in their community. Susan?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the education model that we currently kind of fall under, certainly in this country, it misses the mark in terms of creating the whole person. You know, we do a lot of compartmentalizing of, you need to learn this math equation, you need to learn this piece of history, you need to learn how to write a 5-paragraph essay. But what are we teaching K-12 students in terms of how to live in the world? It's remarkable that there's not a lot of emphasis on living skills, life skills, because as a college teacher, when I send these students off, I feel like this is only one piece of the whole person that you're going to become or that you are in the moment, but you need so much more. And so take this as part of who you are and keep it in your pocket. But remember that there's much more to being a human in the world and to interact with other people. And I feel like we don't do that enough in terms of how we educate the kids from the very young age up to coming into college. Because I certainly know that Project Censored often is like just a mind-blowing experience for students when they start working on this project. It feels like, wow, I've never even like imagined that I should be critical of the media I'm consuming, which to me seems shocking, but that's because I do it for my job.
It was very shocking. I remember, Susan, being in your class and feeling like the veil was lifted. It was incredibly empowering, and I didn't even realize that I could have a voice, because especially with young people growing up now in the midst of internet culture, it's very about the personal brand versus the ideas behind them. It's all about how you present yourself and not how you choose to express yourself, and you empowered us with that capability. And it's almost like I was a victim of censorship, or that young people are being censored all of the time and they're not able to empower themselves with the agency that they need to be an active citizen in the world, because I didn't even realize I could have a voice or that I could use it. And you empowered me with that. So I'm incredibly grateful and I feel very lucky, because that isn't common for young people.
We're fortunate at Project Censored to work with so many amazing students and young people. They're not all young people. We have students from many different ages and demographics that come back to us. Susan and I teach at community college as well as university. We have a really diverse group of people with different experiences, and it's really interesting to see across the spectrum how students in the classroom also help teach each other, almost like learning communities, right? I'd like to remind everyone that you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We have in studio with us today two fantastic student researchers and authors, contributors to Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. They contributed to the Junk Food News chapter. We have Izzy Snow and Christina Hamilton. We also have Professor Susan Rahman with us, who oversaw the research of that chapter with them. After this brief musical break, we're going to come back and we're going to focus on that research, and we're going to dive in and hear about what they wrote about for Censored 2019. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're focusing on one of the many facets that Project Censored works on in our critical media education programs and our critical pedagogy towards social justice. And this is the focus on infotainment culture, and particularly what we call junk food news. Today in studio, we have Izzy Snow, Christina Hamilton, students at College of Marin that were researchers and authors contributing to Chapter 2 of Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. The chapter is titled Blurred Lines and Clickbait. There's another word in the subtitle the FCC won't allow me to say on air. It's the S-hole that is junk food news, riffing on President Trump's commentary, the very disparaging negative comments he made about African countries. I'm sure our listeners can piece together what that word is. But let's start here just with you, Susan Rahman. Just explain to us, how do you go about presenting this chapter? How do you go about sharing the information with students about just getting them started and giving them a template or an outline where they can then jump in and explore and discover what's going on around them?
For the class that we write this chapter in, I've already introduced them to the project. Students are writing VINs, and I'll just redirect you for a second because Izzy Snow also wrote a VIN, so if you know, you can check in on that. But so validated independent news stories, they start the process there where they're hunting down independent news sources, hunting down stories that they find significant, and then they're doing what we call a summary VIN that they turn in and that gets thrown into the mix for the candidate stories for the top 25. So they've already had an experience with an understanding of what independent news is as opposed to corporate media. So they're at the point where they're kind of more savvy than just coming in from nothing. Then we kind of flip it. So this junk food news idea is like, what is in the news that is just so absurd, but it's just taking up a lot of space, right? And so I usually leave it to them to come up with the junk because actually they probably know more than me about what is junk and what is out there. It's actually really fun for me to hear like, okay, what's the latest? And then they come in with these absurd stories. And so We usually work in small groups, you know, maybe three or four students on a story, and the chapter usually takes up about four or five stories in general. The idea behind junk food is that it's entertaining and it's absurd, so we highlight those stories, but the backstory or the part that is the critical media literacy piece is then, what is it that we're not talking about in relation to that? And what is taking up the space so that we can't even really see the other thing going on? And so the first part for them is to gather the junk, which again, doesn't seem like it's that hard, right? The junk is easy to find. And then we do a little deeper dive about, well, okay, so let's look at topically, what is that junk? And then how do we look and see what sort of relates to it that isn't being covered? And so we'll talk about that as we're talking today, but there's definitely a lot that's not being covered, and that's where the indie news sources come into play. So we match them up. So a group will have the junk piece, and then they'll also have the indie piece, and they'll describe the junk piece, and then meanwhile, here's what you're missing.
What I really liked about this, though, is that we were able to find like stories that are both junk food and substantial stories that actually have like a theme or connection with them, which was also very fun and creative. And I wasn't expecting that as well. Like Izzy, your story was about the dog that died on the airlines, right? And then you were able to find something else about United Airlines that had actually a far more important effect on the world and on our personal lives and everything. And I thought that was really interesting.
For our story, when we were selecting the junk food news stories, we picked two stories that were in the media news landscape at the same time, but one was given significant more attention than the other. So the story that me and my partner Kyle Zucker chose is about the puppy that died in the overhead bin of the United Airlines flight. While this story exposed animal cruelty, it continued to dominate the headlines for an unnecessary amount of time. What was and is deeply ironic about this story is that it focuses on one instant of animal abuse while thousands of people are trafficked into this country and abused as modern-day slaves. So Kyle and I focused on the Frontline documentary from April 2018 that profiled a group of Guatemalan teens. These teens were lied about the opportunities in the U.S. Then they were forced to work in horrible conditions on a trillium egg farm in Ohio to pay off their $15,000 trafficking fee. So while one story that dominated the headline explored one case of exploitation, human exploitation goes on in this country all the time for thousands and thousands of people. And it just illustrates how much censorship is designed to protect corporate interests, because Julian Egg Farm doesn't want you to know where it gets its workers from, but it has a history of abuse that censorship is covering up.
And it also highlights the point that there's certain people that are here doing a lot of work that don't rate enough to be cared about in the corporate media. I think the contrast that you found with those two stories was really telling. I always say people care more about sad dogs than they do about migrant workers. And to me, that's just highly unfortunate. Not that I don't love dogs. Don't tell everyone Susan doesn't like dogs, because I love dogs. But humans are being violated, abused, and mistreated on a daily basis. And that is not something that the corporate media is covering on a regular basis.
Definitely. And I think you highlight an interesting point, which is the most outrageous and popular junk food news stories in the 2017 to 2018 cycle exploited our gender, racial, and socioeconomic identities that divide us rather than unite us. That's why these stories are able to gain prominence in the landscape, because they are outrageous and they try to attack sort of qualities that divide us, whereas encouraging the empathy and humanity that is needed to move forward.
You know, I think this goes to the root of really what pushed Carl Jensen, the founder of Project Censored. It really pushed him to open up this categorical analysis. The early criticisms of Project Censored, which was founded in 1976 at Sonoma State University, coming from journalists, included people saying, and this is before cable news and before the internet, right? So, you know, might as well be a million years ago for people born after in 2000. These people came to Jensen, who had a career in media, and they said, you know, that's not necessarily fair that you're saying that we're censoring stories. We just use news judgment. And this is back when you don't have the infinite 24/7 news cycle. There's precious column inches and 30-minute network news and that kind of thing. And so Carl, to his credit, said, well, okay, that might be a fair critique. So that's when he said, let me take a look at what you are covering, not just what you're not covering. And then that's what led him to coin junk food news. He's like, if the precious column inches are so prized to you, what are you doing filling them with garbage about O.J. Simpson's chase or the equivalents of Jenners or Kardashians or gossip stuff? And again, we have news media that is entertainment media and gossip media and so on. But what we're looking at coming through the last 30, 40 years is how much that has bled over into actual allegedly hard-hitting news.
Hence the title of the chapter, Blurred Lines. I mean, if not now, more than ever, there's certainly this news porn stuff that's going on in terms of, it was interestingly difficult to find the line. Like, is it junk? Is it not junk? It's sort of junky, but maybe we need to know this. I mean, we figured it out, but it's certainly been blurred to the degree that our president is a reality show star and we're looking at Jeff Bezos' junk, those kinds of things. But then what's important about those is that there's also decisions being made to benefit or not benefit most of humanity. And so how do we dig into one piece and not dig into others? And the convenience of the blurred lines is that we can focus on something absurd so that we're not looking at that same person's heinous acts.
It's as if we're in a hyper-reality TV show now. I mean, again, it's almost every day in the headlines. Michael Avanti, the attorney from Stormy Daniels, is now up on new charges. I mean, again, it's almost as if it's the thing we don't want to look at and can't turn away from. And the blurred line element also is something that led the second director of the project, Peter Phillips, to create a news abuse section very specifically because of the exact tightrope walk you discussed.
Yeah.
Is it newsworthy? Yes, it is, but not the way the corporate media is covering it. This year in the 2019 book, Susan Rahman, you and your students helped us separate the news abuse and junk food news chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really helps people see more clearly something that is blurred and something that is far more common. Izzy, Christina, what can you add to that? In your experience of researching that, tell us about some of your thought processes and some of what went on in the stories that you looked at. Maybe how you chose the stories.
I had a group and one person had the great idea about doing Stormy Daniels, and she was the one who kind of brought it up with us. And we were like, that sounds great. We'll do it. The thing was, though, just like you're saying, news abuse, the Stormy Daniels payoff and everything was part of such a huge factor because it actually could have been a federal offense, the payoff that Michael Cohen did. And of course, now everyone knows Michael Cohen. They know Stormy Daniels. And it's honestly so surprising that we wrote this like a year ago. And now these people are still in the news for all these reasons. Like you said, Michael Avenatti, who is
starting Nike, allegedly.
Garagos, another celebrity lawyer. So it's just all this stuff, and it just never really goes away. And that's another thing, too, that was surprising for me. Even after we were done writing it, you think, okay, book is literally closed, we're done, but you never really move on. This stuff has repercussions. My group focused on the Stormy Daniels thing and just the aspect of the entertainment again. Well, what about these other things going on? What about the payoff? What about the actual criminal offenses that this is suggesting? But no, you're just focusing on this one porn star. The other part, the more legitimate part that we focused on, was this big bill called FOSTA SESTA. Stop Enabling Sex Trafficking Act is the SESTA part that was in the Senate version. It passed because it's supposed to help stop human trafficking. Who would want to say no to that? But a lot of sex workers, consensual sex workers, and ACLU and other organizations for like human rights and everything were actually against this because it would actually endanger not only consensual sex workers, but also the actual victims of trafficking.
I just want to remind listeners that the SESTA is Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, SESTA, and that passed 97-2 in the Senate. The other was FOSTA, and it says here that it's the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, so our listeners can track those.
Yes, thank you, Mickey. So anyway, again, it seems like a good thing that you'd want to support, but it actually would make traffickers go underground and make it so that consensual sex workers would not have the safe safety networks that they put for themselves online. But a lot of places like Craigslist and Reddit, a lot of sex workers would have their own communities where they would help each other and look out for each other. And these were taken away because, of course, this bill that passed around the same time Cohen's office was raided by the FBI the first time.
Michael Cohen,
yeah. Yes.
So you were mentioning Cohen and the raiding of the office and so on. It's also the case that Democrat in the Senate from Oregon, Ron Wyden, said that FOSTA SESTA is an enormous chilling of free speech. So that was another one of the components of this.
What this bill was going to do and has done is make it so that people can actually sue those websites. And so to protect themselves, they ended up dropping a lot of different boards like Reddit and Craigslist, those places where sex workers or even just the traffickers that they're trying to find, they go further underground. So they're harder to find for the people to prosecute and find and actually do what it purported to do. And the thing is, too, again, like I wouldn't have known about this unless I did this project and went into this class and did this. I had no idea about it because, again, it's not reported in the news. And then I've been periodically going through it and like looking up FOSTA SESTA online and saying, well, what's being done? Is it actually having these repercussions that we wrote about in the book and said that people were worried about? And it actually has had an adverse effect. There was a Rolling Stone article a few weeks ago where they're talking about journalists asking Democratic hopefuls about decriminalizing sex work because New York is trying to decriminalize it. And Bernie Sanders, he said, I don't have an answer for that. And Kamala Harris, who actually supported FOSTA SESTA and was against decriminalizing sex work in California, she was like, yeah, I'm supporting of it. But then there's like nothing to really show for that because, again, she is a huge supporter of FOSTA SESTA and sees it as like this huge success. But really, in effect, it's actually harmful to people and not doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Definitely. And I think what Christina discovered and what I noticed when we were editing the chapter is that the Stormy Daniels story is an excellent example of how fake woke news sources are basically just cleverly disguised junk food news or censorship that prioritize blitzy media blitz headlines over important issues such as SESTA, FOSTA. And Christina and I talked about how all of these celebrity sponsorships were tied to the passing of SESTA, FOSTA. And so this like fake woke news sources that aim to tell stories that are progressive values but are actually just more junk food news and a more sinister form of censorship are blurring the lines between junk food news and more important investigative news. And one of the ways in which they do this is that they commodify anger and activism. Righteousness is a GIF or a call out or a 30-second video of Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is not an investigative or fact-based news story. It's about commodifying anger and activism.
Very important points. Thank you for sharing that. And again, if you want to read more about what Christina and Izzy were just talking about, it's in Chapter 2 of Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. Susan Rahman, the professor teaching the class and helping oversee the research and put the chapter together. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this brief musical break, we'll return and continue talking about junk food news. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're looking at Project Censored's junk food news. We are very fortunate to have a couple of the student author and researchers in studio with us today. We are joined by Izzy Snow and Christina Hamilton, who contributed to Blurred Lines and Clickbait in Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion on Junk Food News. We're also joined by Dr. Susan Rahman, professor at College of Marin, that helps oversee the students doing the research and writing of this chapter, and of course also our validated independent news and underreported chapters and many other things, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of that in this segment. But I wanted to go back to our junk food news topic, because one of the things that goes on in the writing of this chapter, I used to work on this chapter with a lot of students in previous censored volumes, and one of the things that we did is that we took liberty to be a little more pithy. That's P-I-T-H-Y. In other words, we didn't hesitate to take blogger-like pot shots at some of the people in the corporate media that clearly are educated to know better than to chase these clickbait headlines and stories. I mean, perhaps they're also doing the bidding of their paymasters, boards of directors, CEOs, advertisers, et cetera, to invoke the propaganda model here and how that shapes news and information. But one of the things that I know that I had a good time doing with my students, and this was one of their favorite parts, was coming up with like the catchy titles, the catchy headlines, the double entendres, the things that really poked at what was going on in the story. Earlier, Izzy, you were talking about the story, the sad story about the puppy, and your subtitle for that is Puppy Eyes Before Human Rights. And that's, well, that's that kind of sums that section up. And then the last section that you all were talking about regarding FOSTA SESTA was Sex, Lies, and Shark Week, right? That was another one of the titles. So, and there's several other things that you all talk about here, including one of my favorite epigraphs in the entire book. People that read Censored for a long time knows what a fan of these we are. And you all started it out with a great quote from the comedian and social critic Michelle Wolf from the 2018 White House Correspondents' Dinner. You want to read it for
us,
Izzy?
Yeah, so I picked the quote because I thought it just perfectly articulated the reality of the, whatever you want to call it, post-truth, subjective truth world, is the fact that at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the dinner where the White House press is celebrated, Michelle Wolf comes out and has this incredible joke where she says to the White House correspondents at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, "You guys love breaking news, and you did it. You broke it. Good work." "The most useful information on CNN is when Anthony Bourdain tells me where to get noodles." So here, Michelle Wolf notes that CNN loves to churn out catchy headlines to get viewers, but if every story is treated with the same severity, this will not differentiate between the more important news and the fluffy junk food news stories.
Indeed. And you have a few more in this chapter. Would you like to share with our listeners a little bit about a couple of the other stories? You can go into as much or little detail as you want. Just to share with our listeners the research that you all did. And you know, look, I want to make sure our listeners also know that putting together these books every year is really a lot of work. It takes place over a period of a few months. It's no small feat to be putting together a chapter this size, let alone the rest of the book that we all work with hundreds of students and scores of professors on 15 campuses across the country. And of course, in this chapter, you know, there are one, two, three, four, about six or seven different student contributors, right, that you all worked with. So if there's something else you want to share with us, what are a couple of the other things that you all looked at?
The Junk Food News chapter identifies the most important stories from the 2017-2018 news cycle that were overshadowed by superficial, sensationalized media blitz. One of these stories, which is under the subsection Sticks and Stones, but FCC Hall has hurt SAFA. So this story focused on the coverage of Trump's FCC Hall comment in January 2018. The piece itself explored how the coverage of the FCC Hall comment, which lasted for the first few months of 2018, overshadowed the coverage of the Securing America's Future Act, or SAFA. The FCC Hall comment exposes Trump's racism, but SAFA is a form of institutional racism that attempts to criminalize DACA recipients and gives law enforcement more power. So we explored that in that subheading. And then we had another one that discussed the Kylie Jenner baby gossip story. It was called Keep Up with Kylie and Neglect Black Infant Mortality. So this section discussed how the black infant mortality crisis was virtually ignored by the press while they focused on Kylie Jenner's pregnancy rumors and then her baby. The black infant mortality crisis reveals the ways in which structural, institutional, and social racism affect the pregnancies of black women and the mortality of their infants. The book notes that groups such as Black Lives Matter and Showing Up for Racial Justice call attention to the racial disparity of black infant mortality, while the corporate press continues to neglect the issue in favor of celebrity baby talk. And then we included the Sex, Lies, and Shark Week story and the Puppy Eyes Before Human Rights. But an interesting point that I want to talk about, which we talk about in the discussion, is the chapter itself begins with the quote, "The reality TV president has found his reality TV press." So we discussed the ways in which Trump is very much the white whale of junk food news, as his goal is to entertain and not to inform the public. And this articulates the post-truth subjective truth and the ways that he galvanizes fake news to censor important dissenting voices.
Susan Rahman, why don't we bring you back into the conversation here, since you were the maestro conductor over the chapter and the students went out and played their parts.
They did.
They really did. They've done such a fantastic job. And you always do such a great job helping and lead the way. What do you think about the work that they did? And I know you're doing this again right now this year for Censor 2020 through the Looking Glass. I mean, again, really important work.
I think they did a remarkable job. I think it was just a really amazing effort on the part of a good majority of them to really pull their weight and to come up with some great content and whip it into shape. That was a team effort to do that. But in general, I mean, I think it's a really fun project for them because, as you said, it's pithy, it's fun, it's sarcastic. It is poking fun at all of the things that we imagine to be academia or news for that matter. And so
good satire.
Yeah, it's good satire. It's funny because when we first start out doing Project Censored type stuff, they're like, wait, this isn't the 5-paragraph essay. This isn't the whatever. And I'm like, no, it's something different. Let's go this way. And at first it's a little foreign to them. And then once they kind of dig their teeth into it, they're like, this is really neat. And so being able to joke in a written form was really a neat experience for them. And I'm getting ready to do it again. We're gearing up for junk food in about a week in the class that I'm teaching right now. And the homework is go tell me what the junk is. Right?
Go turn on the TV.
Yeah. They're like, oh, this is the homework? Yeah. Come back with the junk. And so we're thinking through that right now. But I think just in general, having the ability to churn out this piece of published material is a gift to them in so many ways. I mean, it's a gift to all of us. If you care about media literacy and if you appreciate the work that independent journalists do, then this sings to you. It sings to people. Clearly, I'm in that category. I find this to be very meaningful work. But I think having this opportunity for students is really unique. So, I mean, if there's faculty out there listening, this is really an amazing project to do with students. It empowers them. Izzy said earlier she didn't know she had a voice. I mean, I think that's the biggest crock of media in general. Go back to the 5 filters. Go back to Chomsky and Herman. Think about who gets to be a voice, who gets to be newsworthy. I call FCC, you know what, on that, because I think everybody can be a journalist. I mean, I know everyone can be a journalist. I know everybody can tell a story. And so this kind of shows students that they actually are valuable and that their words matter and that there's a place for them to make news. And I mean, I know we have social media and I know there's those opportunities, but this is a formalized opportunity through the project, a vetted organization that then speaks truth to power and highlights these student voices in a way that is very profound and I think very life-changing. I mean, I think for students who have done this and found it to be meaningful, you know, you talk to them 20 years later and they're still like just really enamored with the experience and perhaps have been changed forever. I mean, if you think about Doug Hecker, who's one of the filmmakers from the second Project Censored film, he harkens back to his days at Sonoma State when he did Project Censored with Peter Phillips in a sociology class. And he said, that changed me. And since then, he's been a diehard supporter of the project and has helped produce and make the documentary and continues to work and sits on the board. It's really an amazing project. And I feel really honored that I get to be a part of it. And I really, really enjoy sharing it with my students. It's one of those things where it doesn't sit well with top-down teaching. It's a more collaborative effort. And for me, that's the way I enjoy teaching anyways. And so to be able to share ideas and to work as a team, they teach me, I teach them. Mm-hmm. And then we bring our work out and share it with other people. And I just think it's a nice model.
Talk about social justice pedagogy, you know, and the idea that people have equal voice and everyone's there working together for a greater cause, for something bigger than all of us. And everybody contributes something different and unique. Echoing what you just said, Susan Rahman, I feel incredibly privileged to be able to work with so many great students and other faculty and other people in the community. It's really amazing. And I want to say, too, that, you know, this print book is by Seven Stories Press out of New York. This is a respected independent publisher. This is a real hold-in-your-hand hard copy book. That's academic, not in the pejorative sense, but in a substantive sense.
Absolutely.
And that these undergraduate students are also getting material that they can put on their CV and their resume and their experiences in public speaking. I mean, this is a real service learning opportunity.
100%. And I think that the ways in which the Project Censored philosophy, pedagogy, whatever you want to call it, has been brought into my classroom has been highly, highly academic, I guess you could say, but also just really empowering for students. You know, the other thing that I didn't talk about yet is that this group of students from last year hosted the biannual conference at College of Marin. And if you're talking about stuff that goes on a CV, this is something that these students, they're conference planners, organizers, workshop leaders. I had to be a teacher for 10 years before I could put that on my CV. And so just the work that went into that, the collaborations with people all over the country and even some international people coming in, bringing ideas, sharing ideas, hosting a conference. I mean, they sat with me and we went through all the proposals and we organized the structure and we read their proposals. This was a lot of really hands-on work in order to prepare this conference. And it turned out to be a delightful experience, I think, for most people. I think for the most part, it was a really neat experience. And the coming together of the intergenerational learning, which I think is something that, again, our education system is missing, where we all could sit at the table, where we all could have a voice and we could all talk about what we do and we could all look at each other and go, oh, that's really neat. I really like what you're doing. Wow, that's cool. I might try that. And I think there's just so much opportunity for academic growth as well as personal growth and some social justice.
This was Media Freedom Summit 2.0, the Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice that was held at College of Marin last late October. And I know we've aired a few of the panels here and we had a fantastic all-woman journalist keynote roundtable discussion one of the evenings. Again, and there were so many student-led panels. On the other end of the spectrum, something that we'll be sharing with the Project Censored audience in the near future is we had an historic conversation at the other end of the generational spectrum with Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott. Again, I just feel privileged to be part of any of this and working with these students. Izzy and Christina, what's your feedback from some of that work?
It was a lot of work. It was amazing. I don't think we really knew what to expect at the beginning. We just knew like, oh, we're doing a conference. it felt like a total blur until October happened, and then it was doing all the panels. And one thing I really enjoyed about the panels was I would see some of the older people in the audience or even on the panel go up to the students and say, oh, that was amazing. I did not know about that. And that was just such a cool thing to like be involved in.
Well, we're really glad that you were involved in it, because that's how it got pulled off between Susan and the great students there. I mean, it was a really incredible kind of event. Izzy?
I found that my experiences at the Media Freedom Summit really solidified the classroom content and the curriculum that I learned in school, but then expanded upon that. And I was able to see how I can use my voice in a national, in a local, in a communal sense, but then translate that into work with other people. And Christina makes a really interesting point about the intergenerational experience. And I made so many new friends and met so many amazing people. And it just really felt like an incredible opportunity. But it was also just really exciting to see, because you don't really get that experience a lot of times when you're in the classroom. You're inside of the confines of the curriculum. You do the essays, you do the tests, but then you're sort of out of there. But this makes the whole independent news landscape your classroom. And it gives you the tools to sort of empower yourself with skills that are beyond any sort of education or degree or anything like that, but how to conduct yourself as a citizen of the world.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of this ability to take what you learn and share it, which we don't get to do often. I'm reminded of my dissertation that like two people read, right? You write this big sucker and then you're like, I did it. And nobody gets it. Nobody understands, because it's a very insular kind of experience. Whereas all the work that you guys have done and all the conference attendees, they've done throughout their careers, then we came together and shared it. And it was so neat to keep the conversation going. And I think that solidarity is really important, because what we know is that it's very easy to succumb to something like just, okay, then I'm just going to, you know, look at BuzzFeed and I'm just going to get on my Facebook and forget about the news. But this reminds everyone that no, actually, it's really important that we're all aware and that we're all sharing ideas and that we're all talking about these things, and whatever each of our individual activism looks like, that we're keeping up with it. Because this is not just to say, wow, we've got so many problems out there. It's like, wow, we've got so many problems out there, and there's work to be done, and I want to do it. And when there's good stuff out there, it's good to share that as well. I think it's invigorating.
I'd like to remind everyone that you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We have in studio with us today two fantastic student researchers and authors, contributors to Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. They contributed to the Junk Food News chapter. We have Izzy Snow and Christina Hamilton. We also have Professor Susan Rahman with us, who oversaw that chapter with them. After this brief musical break, we're going to come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're focusing on one of the many facets that Project Censored works on in our critical media education programs and our critical pedagogy towards social justice. And this is the focus on infotainment culture, and particularly what we call junk food news. Today in studio, we have Izzy Snow, Christina Hamilton, students at College of Marin that were researchers and authors contributing to Chapter 2 of Censored 2019,
Fighting the Fake News Invasion. The chapter is titled Blurred Lines and Clickbait. And Izzy Snow, we mentioned earlier that you also contributed to the book in the first chapter, People Bust Across U.S. to Cut Cities' Homeless Populations. That was one of the validated independent news stories. And so, you know, you're also being really attuned to how censorship works in a country like the United States that purports to have a free press system. And not only do you learn about how censorship works in the junk food chapter, but here you are looking at the independent press and how the corporate press either distorts or ignores it entirely. Do you want to share a couple words about some of the experiences you had with that story?
That was an incredible example of applying the classroom content into a work that I will carry with me for the rest of my life, and the sort of experiences that transcend the classroom environment. And this story really demonstrated how really important news stories are completely censored to protect corporate interests. So this was an investigation by The Guardian that observed homeless relocation programs in major cities in the U.S. It was an 18-month-long investigation, and they calculated 34,240 journeys from 2011 to 2017. So what these programs did is they gave the homeless population one-way bus tickets or plane tickets out of the cities. It was designed as a cheap and effective way of cutting homeless populations. And there were no follow-up or job programs, and more than 20,000 homeless people took part in these programs, and 80% of them were moved to cities with a lower median income. An example is San Francisco, which in 2005, the homeless population was 6,250. In 2007, it was 7,600, and 10,570 people were bussed out in 12 years. And so this exemplifies the ways that San Francisco uses the data from the bus programs to demonstrate that they are helping the homeless population. So it really just quantifies the ways in which their humanity is taken away from them. They are basically data to benefit the city, and how these sort of social programs don't actually benefit homeless people. They're just a way to get their numbers down.
Such an important story. And of course, that was out of the Guardian of London that you had to read about that. So again, in there is another lesson about the importance of independent journalism. And of course, the importance of critical media literacy education to attune us to these kinds of sources that aren't ready at the click, right? When we walk in the door, the corporate media that hands it to you on the platter. We should obviously be suspect of that. Christina Hamilton, anything else you'd like to add here today?
As part of the Media Freedom Summit, and also we had the book launch for the 2019 book when it came out, and I was very fortunate. Again, I work at Copperfields Books, and I was able to have it so that we could host a little mini panel with Mickey and Susan and another professor, as well as other student journalists who contributed to the book. And I think between the whole panel, like, how many bins were represented?
Like six or seven.
Yeah, quite a number.
Yeah.
Ken Burroughs was there.
Yeah.
And his students,
they both had multiples in there. And then Kyle Zucker, again, he had the number one story and he got to talk about that. So that was really cool. And again, it's that whole communal aspect of Project Censored, where it's literally outside the classroom for me, where I got to bring in my work and I got to bring in students and the community. I've hosted author events before, but never actually been part of the author event. Like, being an author was pretty cool, and just being able to say, hey, that's my book over there. I'm in that book. I helped write it. It's all of our book.
Yeah, that's what's
so
great
just,
about it.
Yeah, so it was just such a cool experience. I'm just so grateful for that.
Andy Lee Roth and I are ever grateful. We feel really honored to work with so many fantastic students and faculty and people in the community. And Susan, just another nod to you and Kyle Zucker, who couldn't be here today. Kyle did have what ended up being the number one story on the global decline in rule of law as basic human rights diminish. And Susan, you were the faculty evaluator of that story. I also want to remind listeners that if you're interested in learning more about how to get involved in the project, whether it's junk food news, news abuse, the media democracy chapter, the VINs in the chapter one censored stories, maybe radio, etc., go to projectcensored.org and get in touch with us. Whether you're an educator, concerned community member, somebody that wants to be involved or already is involved and wants to cross-pollinate with our networks, right? Absolutely get a hold of us. And that's why community radio is such a fantastic resource for us to communicate these things, because you're not going to hear about Project Censored on NPR or PBS, and you're not going to hear about it on the corporate news media. Probably one of the biggest censored stories of the last 43 years the project has been in existence is literally the project itself. Which hasn't been mentioned in corporate media very often. So, Susan Rahman, any concluding remarks from you for today's program?
I think just really thank you for bringing this full circle, because this is another piece of that, taking it out into the real world as opposed to just keeping it insular in a classroom. Just for these guys to come here and to talk about what they've done and to give them the opportunity to share and be heard. I mean, I think it's just a really great opportunity. And I am really fortunate to be able to work with such brilliant people. These two women in particular have blown my mind again and again. And I'm just really lucky. I'm really thankful, very privileged. And the project means a lot to me. And I'm so happy I get to share it in the classroom.
And I can only echo Susan's sentiments there with my students at Diablo Valley College and California State University East Bay. We all do what we can to really try to create a better, more informed, and more just society. And it's a team effort. So I want to thank Izzy Snow, Christina Hamilton, Dr. Susan Rahman. Thank you so much for joining us today again on the Project Censored Show.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
So that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, and a reminder to some of our listeners in the audience, KSKQ up in Ashland, Oregon. I will be at Southern Oregon University. I will be there Thursday, April 18th, 7 p.m. I'll also be in town the following day for a meet and greet. And I know KSKQ has played the Project Censored Show for a long time. So if you are in the Ashland-Medford area, hope to see you in mid-April. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I am the executive producer, Mickey Huff, and host of the program, along with my co-host, Chase Palmieri, who will return with us next week. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on around 50 stations across the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work and find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Also check out our sister podcast, Along the Line. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Vandana Shiva, Oneness versus the 1%. When I first met Vandana Shiva in 1992 around the campaigns against the WTO and globalization, she was well known as protector of seeds and a brilliant critic of biotechnology. Her most recent 2019 book, Oneness versus the 1%, culminates that work in an amazing indictment of a new worldwide power center reaching from Monsanto to artificial intelligence. Vandana Shiva describes what she calls a poison cartel comprising of Bayer, that just took over Monsanto, to Dow, that has merged with DuPont, and Syngenta, that has merged with ChemChina. What these corporations have in common is the control of our foods, and the chemicals used on them. They are defining industrial agriculture and have enormous impact on climate change. On March 30, 2019, Vandana Shiva was the guest of Chris Hedges on his TV program On Contact. What shocked and surprised him was that this poison cartel has already entered strategic alliances with internet giants and promoters of artificial intelligence such as Bill Gates, Facebook, and Amazon. Here's renowned author and lecturer Chris Hedges introducing Vandana Shiva.
There is a worldwide crisis caused by industrial farming. The commodification of food by corporations has altered the ways we produce, process, and distribute food to serve corporate profit rather than people's health and well-being. Industrial agriculture poisons the soil and water and uses its economic monopoly to destroy the ability of small farmers to sustain themselves and their families. The reconfiguration of food production is degrading our ecosystem as well as our health. There are 1 billion people across the globe who endure hunger and malnutrition, and 2 billion who suffer from diseases including diabetes, heart disease, and obesity caused by processed foods loaded with chemicals, fat, and sugar. The pesticides used by industrial agriculture have contributed to an epidemic of cancers. Food, in short, has become another commodity. The natural world is treated as a machine. If we are to survive as a species, it will mean radically changing how we produce the food we consume. Joining me in the studio to discuss global food production is the physicist and environmental activist Vandana Shiva, whose newest book is Oneness Versus the 1%. Where do you see us going unless we wrest power back over our own food production?
The first thing I see happening is people hating each other and killing each other in conflicts everywhere, either conflicts of the kind we see in places around Nigeria, where the Lake Chad disappears because of the same kind of farming. Or we'll see more and more conflicts over natural resources. We're going to see more and more disease epidemics. We're going to see more and more desertification. The UN has said the desertification of the soil by chemical farming is the single biggest ecological crisis. And then, along with the 200 species being driven to extinction every day, every UN body has said 100 years, and we are gone if we don't change path.
It was the Punjab, which was the model for the so-called Green Revolution, and that tipped off your own work. Begin there, what you saw, what you began to understand, and now, of course, you've become a leading worldwide authority on all of this.
First, it's a pleasure to be on the program with you, Chris. I did my MSc honors in particle physics in Punjab between 68 and 73. It was a peaceful, prosperous land, the most prosperous part. It's the land of five rivers. Panj is five.
That was kind of the breadbasket of India.
It always was a big producer, but part of what the Green Revolution did was concentrate rice and wheat production in Punjab with very intensive water inputs, very intensive chemical inputs, very intensive financial inputs, all driven by conditionalities because in 65 we'd had a drought. And India needed a little more wheat import to regulate the prices, not because people were starving, but the United States and the chemical industry had been trying to push chemical farming on India. And they said, we'll send you wheat only if you also change your agriculture to be chemical agriculture. The name given was the Green Revolution.
Right.
Not very green,
right.
Not very revolutionary.
Right.
And what I found through my studies for the United Nations University is first that the Green Revolution didn't grow from within India. It was imposed by the chemical industry, by the US government and the World Bank, as every bad policy of the world is.
Right.
Basically, they changed the wheat varieties, which is what the Borlaug invention was, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize for it. And the reason I woke up to Punjab was I said, this was the land of peace, now it's a land of war. Green Revolution gets a Nobel Peace Prize. There's not much peace here, so what went wrong?
And how, because it's an important point, which we've seen replicated around the globe, how is it that the commodification of agriculture, seizure of agriculture by industrial farming creates conflict.
Let me come back to how they change the seed to push the chemicals. These chemicals need more water. That's one place of the conflicts. They also create a situation where farmers don't decide what they'll grow and how they'll grow it. The package of industrial farming is a package where industry decides what inputs.
Even if you're a farmer that has your own land.
Autonomously, the farmers used to in India decide what they grew. The Green Revolution tried to bring the U.S. model of industrial farming. And the emergence of the conflicts, the Sarbat Khalsa was one declaration. They said it so clearly. When we don't decide how we'll grow our food and what price it'll sell at, we are living under conditions of slavery. And I think this is exactly what an American farmer would be saying today. They're not deciding what they'll grow. They didn't choose GM soya. I asked them in 92, why are you growing GM soya?
And they said, Explain what that is.
Genetically engineered soybean. Soybean is not a staple of the United States. It began in East Asia. Genetically modified Roundup resistant soybean has been made resistant to Monsanto's Roundup, which is now established to be a carcinogen. There's a major case that Monsanto, now bought up by Bayer, has recently lost. In California, it's the case of Johnson, and the entire jury unanimously said, yes, the cause of the cancer was Monsanto's Roundup. Now they're genetically engineering crops to be able to withstand Roundup with the idea that you will now control weeds, but the weeds have become super weeds.
Right, you're right about that, yeah.
But coming back to how farmers don't choose, and the part of the food system that's gone totally crazy, besides the poisons in our food, is that farmers are spending more and more buying patented seeds, buying costly chemicals, buying irrigation inputs, and they're selling whatever they grow at next to nothing. The prices are falling. And Monsanto had a debate in the United Nations, because I played a big role in the Convention on Biological Diversity, which was part of the Earth Summit. The Monsanto representative said so clearly, they said, by the time we are finished, the corn the farmer grows will have zero value. It's the genes we put into it that'll have the value.
Let's talk about Monsanto, because from the book, I didn't realize Monsanto was as big as they are, and I didn't realize how diversified they are. And you actually link them to Facebook, Bill Gates. It's quite a frightening kind of global cartel, including control of systems of information about farming.
Absolutely. So the latest that has happened is that those companies that had been involved in Hitler's Germany to make chemicals to kill people in concentration camps have reconverged as what I call the poison cartel. And Bayer has merged with Monsanto, Syngenta has merged with ChemChina, and Dow has merged with DuPont, and all other chemical companies, all other seed companies, and these are also the pharmaceutical companies. They give you cancer, and they have the medicine for cancer. Now, what is Monsanto? First of all, Monsanto wasn't in the seed business. It made chemicals. It made Agent Orange. It's when genetic engineering as a possible tool became available, they said, we can now own the seed. This is the reason I started to save seeds. This is the reason I started Navdanya, the movement for seed freedom. And they said, we are going to write new laws internationally, which became the agreement on intellectual property in the WTO. But I said, no, you don't create life, you don't invent life. And therefore, we are going to not only not allow this internationally, nationally in India, we put in clauses in our patent law, Article 3J, which says patents can't be given on seeds, plants, and animals because human beings don't invent it. Monsanto started to buy up every seed company by suing them. Their method is sue a company till the company gets tired and sells out.
And what's their case? What case do they bring against
them? They bring a false claim of ownership. They've done that in
India. They own the seeds they're
selling. They own the seed. Like, they didn't have a patent on BT cotton. They've sued every Indian seed company to say, we own the seed. And therefore, you have to keep paying higher and higher royalties. This was a case in the Supreme Court till 2 weeks ago. Monsanto has bought up the entire seed industry. But now the two applications...
We're talking about globally.
It is globally, they are the biggest seed giant. Now with Bayer, Monsanto are. They've used the tools of acquisition and mergers. They've used the tools of the two applications of genetic engineering, BT toxins in the cotton crop and Roundup Ready, soya Roundup Ready corn. They collect royalties. My assessment says U.S. farmers are paying Monsanto $10 billion a year in addition to the cost of seed for the royalty payment. It's a new rental system. Just like we had landlords, Monsanto is the new life lord. But the techniques are failing. So are they then saying, no, let's get back to farmers' varieties. Let's get back to breeding.
But explain why they're failing, because there's a figure somewhere in the book where you talk about the destruction of seed varieties.
Well, they have absolutely wiped out seed diversity. In India, we used to have 200,000 rice varieties. The Green Revolution narrowed it down. We used to have hundreds and thousands of cotton varieties, including colored cotton, the purple, the blue. Monsanto allowed only BT cotton, BT cotton, BT cotton. There's an antitrust case going on in India right now that this is a prima facie monopoly when one company controls 99% of the seed and it has only one trait, the toxic trait. It's supposed to control pests, but the pests have become resistant because evolution is part of nature. Just as in America, the weeds have become resistant. So instead of controlling pests and weeds, you have super pests and super weeds.
You've diminished your variety.
You've diminished your variety. You've increased vulnerability. So now they're stealing the seeds we have saved. In Navdanya, we've saved seeds that can tolerate salt. So when the hurricane comes with the salt from the ocean, we can grow those crops. We've helped rehabilitate after the Orissa cyclone, the tsunami, because of the salt.
One of the things in the book you pointed out that they're buying up climate resistant.
They are stealing climate resilient seeds. They're stealing seeds that can tolerate salt, which is the cyclones and hurricanes, floods, and extended droughts. Do they do any breeding work? No, they don't. Mm. This theft is facilitated by the new convergence between companies like Monsanto and IT industry and the Bill Gates.
So that I didn't know, and it's fascinating. But just before that, talk about how the mechanism that Monsanto uses to enforce this kind of iron control in the United States, in India, in countries around the world, where does that power come from?
The power comes from having invented the idea of having invented the seed. That seed is a machine. They put it together. They assembled it. And it's their intellectual property. This is what they went to WTO with. And they said we were the patient, diagnostician, physician all in one.
90% of crop varieties have disappeared.
90% crop varieties have been pushed to extinction by the poison cartel, which is engaged in ecocide.
And not just crop varieties.
Not just crop varieties, because on crops depend the pollinators. And when your plants that feed the monarch butterfly are killed, 90% of the monarch butterfly goes. When your neonicotides and your pesticides are sprayed and the BT toxin in every leaf of the plant releases a poison, your bees disappear. We are in an extinction crisis, and it's this poison cartel that is responsible for it.
Let's talk about the suicides before we get into the IT. I think it's 250,000 Indian farmers have killed themselves, often by drinking the very pesticides. But talk about the social consequences of the quote-unquote Green Revolution.
So the Green Revolution was the first generation. The second Green Revolution is the Monsanto's BT cotton. And the BT cotton really triggered the suicides because Monsanto was collecting royalties illegally, but farmers were taking it on credit. It's the third or fourth year when the agent who had sold the BT cotton seeds to the farmer on credit would say, oh, now your land is mine, that the farmer would drink the pesticide. The latest figure is 310,000, and after that, Monsanto has managed to get the government to not release the data, a very clever tactic. You don't look, you don't see, you can then deny exactly what they've done about the harm of their chemicals. And they've tried it with the issue of the farmers' suicides because the relationships are so intimate. The suicides began in the BT cotton area, and most suicides, even now, are in the cotton area.
And that was not unique to India because I grew up in a dairy farm town. And when all of these small family farms were forced into bankruptcy, we also had suicides. It was very common.
In fact, I read a book called Harvest of Rage, which connected the anger of the rural communities with the Oklahoma bombing. Mm. And if you see that and the parallels to Punjab, the outrage of farmers there, as well as the suicides, there are higher suicides among farmers in every country, in France, in Australia, in the United States and in India. And there's a constant denial. That's why I've called the activities of the poison cartel and the billionaires who back them as ecocide for wiping out the species on this planet. 80% species are gone since the 70s. 90% crop varieties are gone. But genocide too. Because not only is the genocide the pushing of the farmers to commit suicide, but the genocide includes the 200,000 pesticide poisoning deaths. It includes the unnecessary cancer epidemic because of toxics. They are killing people and they're killing the planet.
Let's talk about the IT. I did not know until I read your book how tied in Monsanto and these groups were to the IT industry, and you write a fair bit about Bill Gates.
Well, Bill Gates is really the new front for Monsanto. He was, till last year, the richest man. Jeff Bezos, by the same tricks, right, has beat him up. And Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates are trying in the WTO to get zero-tax e-commerce. So when Jeff Bezos gets a book to you, there'll be no tax on it, where the little publisher will have to pay all of the taxes. And it's this uneven, asymmetric system where they ride on society and give nothing back. So,
but they have philanthropies, don't they?
Their philanthropies are investment. Bill Gates' philanthropies are investments for his future economies. And the future economies are a convergence of the poison cartel and their biotechnology, the information technology, and the new financial technologies based on digital. It's all one continuum. In India, as I've written in the book, our cash was banned in 2016. Overnight, it was illegal. 3 days later, who comes and gives a compliment for forced digital transactions? Bill Gates. We are forced to have a uniform tax system now. Who's benefiting from the software programs? Bill Gates. But not only there, in agriculture, Bill Gates is forcing on Africa the Green Revolution. Right. It's called the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa. He is forcing Africa to accept patents on seed. He's writing the laws sitting in London and getting the governments whom he's made dependent through his philanthropy. His philanthropy is a chain of slavery. And if you look at the new technologies, because the new GM technologies are this thing called CRISPR and gene editing,
right,
he's the main investor. He's also the main investor in a firm called Editas that owns the patents on gene editing. He has launched a whole program called DeepSeek, which is genetic mapping to own seeds. On the climate resilience, they can't invent climate resilience because it's a multigenetic trait. What they do is read a genome, which is the IT part, with an algorithm, make a guess of which part of the genome is leading to the drought tolerance, the flood tolerance, the climate tolerance. And 1,500 patents have been taken through theft. I call it biopiracy. So the next slavery is the convergence of this power, of the poison cartel, the IT industry, and the financial world. And they are going to try every trick to enslave us and fool us. And we have to try every creative imagination to stay free.
Facebook. You write about Facebook.
I write about Facebook because just a few years ago when I'd come to this country, the kids would say, oh, we send the invitation out on Facebook.
Right.
And I'd say, what on earth is Facebook? Oh, a place to send invitations to friends. We found with your last elections how Facebook sold the data, the private data of individuals to Cambridge Analytica, who then used algorithms based on hate to twist the elections to become what they were. But Facebook is also tried to come into India, into agriculture, using their internet systems, smartphones, and telling the farmers what data to buy. Big data is the new commodity. First, they turned food into a commodity. Now they want to turn every bit of knowledge and information into a commodity to sell back to the farmer what the farmer knows anyway, but now make the farmer feel ignorant.
And this, you write, Monsanto acquired one of the world's largest climate data corporations, Climate Corporation, for $1 billion. It acquired the world's largest soil data corporation, Solem Inc. Both companies combined Monsanto's patented GMO seeds with proprietary platforms, which, like seeds, are a source of royalty.
And together, they're looking at insurance, Because if they own the climate data and they own the soil data, they're the ones who are going to tell you what your insurance is worth. And what, and they, the crops, the seeds they sell will be tied to your insurance value.
Well, they're also, I think you're right, at one point there, yeah, they're working with Deere and Company, CNH Industrial and AGCO, to put spyware into farm machinery.
Yes, Chris, and the latest on this is fascinating because, A, they're sending out drones to take photographs. They're sending out robots. They're working with Deere. So John Deere sends out a robot after taking lots of photographs, and it's this partnership. It's supposed to take photographs of healthy plants and the weeds, and it's supposed to kill the weeds. The robot gets it wrong. It kills the healthy plants, and the weeds thrive.
Is this a drone that's spraying then?
Or? They're both. They're drones for spraying. They are talking about farming without farmers. They're talking about driverless tractors. They're talking about no place for human beings. Facebook, Zuckerberg, in his speech at Harvard, said, with artificial intelligence, 99% people will be useless. So we give them a little bit of survival to buy a smartphone to keep busy. So this idea that
let me just interject. You know, that's why they're pushing a guaranteed income.
Yes,
because
exactly.
It's not because they care about sustaining people. It's because they recognize with the trajectory of IT that they won't have a market.
Exactly. It's to buy the smartphone. But the worst is they don't tell you what will be the universal basic income. It will be the $15 that people are demanding in the United States, or will it be the 17 rupees that Prime Minister Modi just announced for his elections to put into farmers' accounts, rather than allow the farmer to have a fair price and not allow the super exploitation by the same industry? Because the junk food industry is also part of this. They're really looking for a huge success, and this is the moment where we as human beings have to look into the future and say, well, we could be extinct tomorrow. Our future depends on knowing the extinction of other species connected to our own. And it also needs in really rejuvenating our multiple intelligence.
Oh, this is the front part of your book, that life is interconnected.
Yes.
You can't kill off the monarch butterflies and 90% of your seed varieties and somehow think you're going to survive.
And you can't kill off large numbers of people and farmers and think there won't be conflicts. And eventually the conflicts come home to you.
And let's get back to the Punjab, which we did, because as you were telling me before, I think, what did you say, 80% of the youth?
75% of the youth are drug addicts today.
Because they've been pushed out.
They've been pushed out, and it's the same reason that female feticide, the killing of the female fetus, the boom began in Punjab at the same time as the Green Revolution. So the farmers commit suicide, the youth become drug addicts, and the girls disappear. According to Amartya Sen, the disappeared girls' number is 35 million in India. And this wasn't happening before we made women disposable in agriculture.
Right.
No, women had a very big role. They were the seed savers. Right, they're the experts. Right. And when you turn your mind to tractors and chemicals and you throw the pesticide spray, women's expertise becomes redundant. And then you think women are disposable. So given this mafia that wants to rule our future and make us extinct, I think it's very much time to say, how many people do they want to make disposable? How many conflicts, though, do they want to sow? It's time for peace and it's time for a future.
You've also, on this front, been pushing back. And a lot of that has been rebuilding local autonomy. Explain.
I started to save seeds because I didn't want Monsanto to own the seed. In the process, we started biodiverse farming. We are finding we can grow 2 times the food India needs by biodiversity, not with chemicals. We are finding farmers earn 10 times more when they grow real food from real seed and for local economies. Local economies are the place for justice and fairness. The globalized economy is a fixed and twisted economy. And we are finding solutions to climate change. We are finding solutions to poverty. We are finding solutions to the water crisis. The water in our farm has come up 70 feet, and we've got 6 times more pollinators. We didn't start a pollinator sanctuary. We just saved seeds. But biodiversity works together in interconnectedness, in oneness.
And yet there's no question that these corporations will make war, are making war, on any alternative autonomous system.
Every day, that is where my energy goes. 90% goes in the creative part of creating alternatives, and 10% in getting them off our backs. And thank goodness we had Gandhi, who taught us that it is a duty to disobey unjust and brute laws. He did it with salt. We do it with seed. We do it with food. We'll keep on the satyagraha. Our satyagraha is for life. Our satyagraha is for the future.
That was environmental activist and physicist Dr. Vandana Shiva speaking about her new book, Oneness versus the 1%.
And that was Chris Hedges, journalist, author, Presbyterian minister, and visiting Princeton University lecturer. His many books include War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and his most recent America, the Farewell Tour. Hedges is a columnist for the progressive news website Truthdig. He hosts the TV program On Contact for the RT. Hedges spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent for print and radio, including the New York Times. On March 30, 2019, he interviewed Vandana Shiva on his TV news program On Contact. Vandana Shiva is an Indian physicist and social activist. The daughter of a forestry official and a farmer, she grew up near the foothills of the Himalayas. She earned her doctorate in Canada and returned to India to work with the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology. In 1991, Shiva launched Navdanya, meaning nine seeds or new gift in Hindi. It was to combat the growing tendency towards monoculture promoted by large corporations. Navdanya formed over 40 seed banks in India. Among her many books are Soil Not Oil, Staying Alive, Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, Monocultures of the Mind, and now Oneness versus the 1%. Thanks for permission to rebroadcast to Chris Hedges and the RT. You can see the full 29-minute video of this interview by searching for Chris Hedges on Contact or following the link on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This archive edition of Radio Curious was originally recorded and broadcast in January 1992 when Radio Curious was called Government Politics and Ideas. Our guest is Pete Seeger, a folk musician and a very special person in the lives of many people around the world. He brings songs of hope, peace, justice, and equality wherever he goes with his 5-string banjo, 6-string guitar, and 12-string guitar. He was an inspiration to me when I first learned to play the 5-string banjo and took lessons from him in what seems long ago and at the same time just yesterday. Our conversation with Pete Seeger began when I asked him what he meant when he said, "The world is in a state of uncertainty." Pete Seeger has been a very special person in the lives of many people around the world.
He brings songs of hope, peace, justice, and equality wherever he goes. I take great pleasure in welcoming Pete Seeger.
Hi, Barry. Over long-distance telephone.
You mentioned when we spoke a little while before our program that you see our world at a crossroads, sort of an age of uncertainty. Could you elaborate on that for us, please?
Well, I guess is around the world there are people firmly certain that they knew how to interpret the events of the world and what things were going to happen. And whether they were religious people or conservative people or radical, depending on how you define those terms, maybe all three, right now they're a little uncertain. I know I'm looking forward to trying to check with other people what to make of the next few years. The collapse of the Soviet system and the communist system, they call it communist system, hanging on in China. I'm a very big fan of the Cuban people, and I think they ought to be allowed to make their own mistakes and not be invaded by us or anybody else. I'd like to see trade established. I think it'd be good for them and good for us. But that's all politics. I've made a living as a musician, and lots of times people say, what's political about this? And I say, well, I hope you'll pat your feet.
Well, there's certainly a blend between music and politics. I know that you've sung about many different aspects of that. How do you see the blend?
In a largest sense, I think everything is politics. Even somebody who says, I never vote, I have nothing to do with politics, that's a very political statement. And somebody who came into your community and tried to persuade people not to vote would be doing something very political. In a sense, every time you're affecting the body politic, whether it's you're having a gang of people watching a football game or a lot of other people watching a comedy on television, you're, in a sense, in politics in some kind of oblique way, even though you're not talking about voting. So I don't draw a sharp line between one thing and another. It's a convenient journalistic thing to say this is sports and this is art and this is politics and this is finance. But face it, in real life, these things are all tangled up.
I know that you have a message on your banjo that maybe you could tell us about what it says and why you chose to put it there, the story behind it.
Well, Woody Guthrie went through World War II with a sign on his guitar, "This machine kills fascists." And he really wanted his guitar to be part of the worldwide struggle to defeat militarism in Japan, Germany, and Italy, which had taken over those countries. I guess you know that the first people that a fascist conquers are the people of his own country. And Mussolini conquered Italy and then went on to try and take over Ethiopia and so on. And Hitler conquered Germany, and Tojo and his gang conquered Japan. My father-in-law was Japanese, and he knew people who were killed by the Japanese fascists.
What was your role? What were you doing during that period of time?
I was drafted, and I served 3.5 years. Can't say I did any fighting. I was first trained to be an aircraft mechanic, and then later on I was in the special service and played the banjo the rest of the war. I was in charge of hospital entertainment on the little island of Saipan in the Western Pacific.
Well, songs make up and mold social comment and social and political change. What kind of role did you see the music that you brought to the little hospital have in the social or the political or the healing change during that time?
Can't say it very much except to give a little distraction and hope, perhaps, to some of the guys who are in bandages. I remember playing the banjo once, playing an old hoedown, and seeing a fellow's toes wiggle out from under. It was the only part of his body I could see. The rest of his body was all wrapped up in bandages, but his toe was out, and I could see his toe wiggling in rhythm to my banjo.
Let's step back about 100 years before you were playing your banjo in Saipan, and talk about the beginnings of the integration movement and the beginning of the abolition movement. But first, I want to play a little cut from a song we all know well, Follow the Drinking Gourd.
Well, the river bank will make a mighty good road. The dead trees will show you the way. Left foot, peg foot, traveling on. Follow the drinking gourd.
Pete, the songs of social change and the integration movement in the United States played an important role, and you played an important role in that. I'd like to know what your thoughts are now that it's well on its way with a long way to go.
Too long a story to tell in a few words, except to say that I feel I'm simply one in a long chain. I learned from people like Woody Guthrie and, or him, Joe Hill. My father was a musicologist, and in the depths of depression, trying to figure ways in which music could help the American people pull themselves together. And I've never been a theoretician so much as my father was. I've simply passed on some of the things I learned from him, namely that music, like any other art, is not something unto itself, but serves to achieve larger ends, individually and in society. And so when I sing somewhere, whether it's a school for small kids or in an old folks' home or wherever, I'm trying to sing songs that will somehow help them understand the world and get ahead.
Maybe I could ask you to talk for a moment about the civil rights struggle in the 60s, or actually beginning in 1956 with the song If You Miss Me from the Back of the Bus, and your role in working in the South and your role in creating the idea that we shall overcome.
Well, I went down south way back in the 40s and 50s and was scratching my head like a lot of other people, white and black, saying, what can be done to end this screwy system of segregation, Jim Crow, they used to call it. And I learned songs that had been made up years ago by black people. I Follow the Drinking Gourd was one of them. And I'd learned songs made up by white people about the situation. Long come the 1950s, I was the first person who ever sang the song We Shall Overcome to Martin Luther King, 1957. And a friend of mine drove him to a speaking engagement the next night. She remembers him sitting in the back seat of the car saying, we shall overcome. That song really sticks, doesn't it? He wasn't a song leader, though. The song didn't catch on then. It was 3 years later when a guy, Carowan, who learned the song from me, brought it to about 70 young people, and they said, oh, Guy, you got a great song, but you don't have the rhythm right. He says, well, that's how I learned it from Pete Seeger. He says, well, we'll show you how the rhythm should be. And they gave it the Motown beat. And that's the way the song spread.
And then the songs were made up on the spot. If You Miss Me from the Back of the Bus, or If You Miss Me from the Cotton Field, You'll Find Me at the Voting Booth. And the people were making songs to create and foment political and social change of the time.
You might consider this, while all around the world people make up songs, there's an especially strong tradition in Africa of improvising new words or new variations musically on old songs. Whether it's a hymn or a blues or whatever it is, you'll find African Americans carrying on an ancient tradition of improvising. I'm not the only person who's noted this. Wyatt T. Walker's written several very good books. And the song We Shall Overcome is the result of many different people improvising over the years. The original of the song was a rather wordy hymn written by Reverend Tindley, a black preacher in Philadelphia in 1903. I'll overcome someday. I'll overcome someday. If in my heart I do not yield, I'll overcome someday. Well, who knows who changed it? Nobody knows, but over 40 years or so, I got changed. And now it's a worldwide song. In a way, I'm glad to see it's still changing a little bit. People keep adding new verses. I was in... Where the heck was I in? In Madison, Wisconsin a while back, and there were four young black women who sang in a quartet in church, and they'd made up what amounted, sound to me, like a rap version of We Shall Overcome. We shall overcome, we shall overcome. Today, today, they said.
In the folk process and the evolution of music, it seems that in an article in Crossroads magazine, you're quoted as saying that you like to use the word folk music as little as possible. Could you tell us why and some of the background on that decision?
Well, there's a tendency in journalism to oversimplify things. And it's good to strive for simplicity, but it's even better to learn to mistrust it. And the word folk music, like many other journalistic words, has gotten so changed that it's almost unusable. 100 years ago, of course, it meant the music of the peasant class, ancient and anonymous. Then along came the Lomax family and collected cowboy songs and lumberjack songs and said, these are folk songs too. Then along comes Woody Guthrie and they tell him, hey, you're a folk singer. And they tell me I'm a folk singer, and I was stupid enough to take their word for it. So now anybody with a guitar is a folk singer. What I'm sorry about is that if you're not on stage with a microphone in front of you, they think you're not a real folk singer. If you're some grandparent simply singing an old song for your grandchild, rocking them to sleep, you're not a folk singer because you're not on stage with a microphone in front of you. Well, this is shit for the birds, but I think the best thing you can do about it is laugh about it and use the word folk music as little as possible.
You're listening to an archive edition of Radio Curious, recorded in January 1992, with folk singing banjo player Pete Seeger. Truly a special person in the lives of many, and a very special person in my life. I'm Barry Vogel. Pete, in terms of making up songs that comment on social issues, let's talk for a moment about the struggle for equal rights for women.
What is equal? What are women? What is struggle?
I guess that provides a lot of questions that could be answered in many different ways.
Yeah, we only got a half an hour. In fact, we only got 15-20 minutes left.
This is true.
We'll say right off the bat, like a lot of men, I got a big education in the 1970s. And I was fortunate to have a family that kept after me until I showed I was learning something.
Perhaps we could...
Wife and sisters. My younger sister, Peggy, you know, wrote the song, I'm Gonna Be an Engineer. I've sung it all over the place.
Perhaps we could move along to anti-war songs. There's a wonderful one, I come and stand at every door.
I come and stand at every door, but none can hear my silent tread. I knock and yet remain unseen, for I am dead, for I am dead. I'm only 7, although I died in Hiroshima long ago. I'm 7 now, as I was then, when children die, they do not grow.
What role do songs against war play in raising the people's consciousness about war and the problems of war?
Well, for thousands of years, songs have been used to get men to go to war. And my guess is, from time to time, people, perhaps often women, have had songs yearning for peace. And sometimes they've even had effect. I was tremendously impressed, very frankly, at the use of songs not only during the Vietnam War here, but just to that, in France, they had songs against the French war in Algeria. And I'd been singing peace songs for many years, but in the Vietnam War, we really saw them take effect. And some of the songs were so simple, it was ridiculous. The little song I sang before 250,000 people in Washington, D.C. in November 1969, I just repeated it over and over and over for about 8 minutes. All we are saying is give peace a chance. We had that whole 250,000 people singing that over and over. I'd shout out between the lines, "Are you listening, Nixon? All we are saying, you better listen, Agnew, is give peace a chance." Like a gigantic ballet, Peter, Paul, and Mary jumped on stage to sing with me and Brother Kirkpatrick. And then on the other side of us, Mitch Miller stood up and started waving his arms and getting everybody singing in time. It was great.
Well, songs of political change often instill fear in people. And I know that about 35 years ago, you were a victim of political fear when you were cited by the House of Representatives for contempt of Congress in 1956. I know that after the trial, or actually during the trial, you wanted to sing one of those songs to the judge. Could you comment on that in retrospect? And then I do want to play the song for our listeners.
Well, it's a good song, and I asked the judge if I could sing it. He says, "You may not." Bang went his gavel. He said, "Bailiff, take him away." They took me down to a jail cell. I only stayed there 4 hours, though, and my lawyer got bail for me. And a year later, the appeals court acquitted me. It was a silly committee. Glad it's no longer a part of Congress, the House Committee on Un-American Activities. I guess Americanism, like art, is in the eye of the beholder.
Let's hear "Wasn't That a Time."
Our fathers bled at Valley Forge. The snow was red with blood, their faith was warm. At Valley Forge, their faith was brotherhood.
Wasn't that a time to thrive? The soul of man, wasn't that a terrible time?
Brave men who died at Gettysburg now lie in soldiers' graves, but there they stem the slavery tide.
have no fear. We dare to reach our hand to other neighbors, far and near, to friends in every land. Isn't this a time? Isn't this a time to free? The soul of man, isn't this a wonderful time? Isn't this a wonderful time?
Pete, I understand that on your banjo now you have a sign or the words, this machine surrounds hate and forces it to surrender. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it is a little different from what Woody had on his guitar 50 years ago. I put the thing on my banjo when he went in the hospital, and I really believe that... What we got to do is persuade the human race that we got to settle our arguments peaceably. It's not going to be easy. It certainly isn't easy. Who knows what the future is going to be? Let's keep our sense of humor and argue about it. Right now, with the tremendous dangers in the world that we'll wipe ourselves off the map by some foolish technology, some foolish militarism. I'm all in favor of arguing, even though words are slippery things and mean different things to other different people. Occasionally, I can see myself getting involved in something violent. I once sang for some students in a big southern university, Duke University. King had just been assassinated, and about 1,000 white college students were sitting down demanding that Duke give more scholarships to black students, and the president, they said, should resign from his white-only country club, and he should bargain in good faith with the maintenance workers, most of them black. I said, you guys sitting out here in the courtyard, you 1,000 people are endangering your college careers. This is the first time this has ever happened at Duke. Congratulations. Why haven't I heard about it? Oh, they said, we called up NBC and CBS, but they said they couldn't spare any cameramen to send anybody down. They said, oh, let us know if there's any violence. We'll send somebody down. Boy, I felt the blood rushing to my head. This is how our country is misgoverned. They're not going to cover a story unless there's violence. It was a great thing they were doing, but it was not going to be covered because no one was breaking any windows. Well, I picked up a big stone from the gravel, and still carry a stone in the banjo case. I don't intend to throw a stone at a person. I've had stones thrown at me. It's no fun. But if I find out they're not going to cover a story simply because there's no violence, I might break a window someplace. I don't know.
Pete, I know that you don't call yourself a folk singer, as you've told us, but in Sing Out magazine, in Volume 4, Number 6, in the May 1954 edition, Alan Lomax is called Pete Seeger America's greatest folk singer. History will endorse this judgment.
Oh, don't pay any attention to people like Lomax.
Pete Seeger, thank you very much.
My life flows on in endless song, above earth's lamentation. I hear the real, though far off, hymn that hails a new creation.
Pete Seeger is a well-known and well-loved folk musician, a player of the 5-string banjo, 6- and 12-string guitar, and the writer of many songs. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, RadioCurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.